Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 256. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, James Jones.
Hey.
Greg Leahy.
Hello.
John Lindemann.
Holla if you hear me.
And special guest, as it was foretold, Carl Castaneda.
We're in a tight spot, boss.
Yeah. Oh boy, we are.
Oh, we are. That's for damn sure.
Really, really tight. Yes. So, as Carl is alluding to, we will be discussing Killer 7.
Not that any of you fuckers would know that, since none of you apparently played it.
Yeah, so in part two of the show, we will be getting into the nitty-gritty of Killer 7, and we have a few excellent forum posts to go over as well. But first, of course, we got new business, and I thought, Carl, as our special guest,
sure,
perhaps you could go first.
Thank you very much, Johnny, and fellows. Good to be here. Well, I got a couple games to talk about. First up is a little game called Miss Splosion Man, which is the sequel to, of course, Splosion Man, which I think came out in like 08 on Xbox Live Arcade. The best way for me to describe Miss Splosion Man is that it is the best Sonic the Hedgehog game since Sonic 3. It is all based on momentum. If you don't know, basically you are a little organism where the only thing you can do is explode. Any face button causes you to explode and you move with the analog stick. So you're in a 2D level, you're just moving forward, and it's literally all about momentum, especially in the sequel now where they've added like sliding rails and moving objects that you have to hop through and stuff that like, you know, barriers that you need to hop over. It is basically Sonic the Hedgehog and it is so, so good.
Do you like it better than the first one?
Yeah, the issue with the first one is like, there is an enormous difference in the difficulty between the first and second, world in Splosion Man.
Mm-hmm.
I can literally play through that first world, like, in my sleep. It's like a reflex. The second world is a lot more difficult, and it's a little cheap, to be honest with you. I love Splosion Man. I think it was probably my favorite game of that year, but I can't deny that it's too hard in spots for a lot of people. Miss Splosion Man is a lot more even in difficulty. And it's honestly just a better game. Like, there's a lot more variety in the levels, which is, I know was one of your complaints, Johnny, when you played Splosion Man, that like, it's just a lab, basically.
Yeah, the art was very samey.
Yeah, that they've really varied it up. You actually get outside the lab in Miss Splosion Man.
Hmm.
And as always, the humor is really, really good. The writing's really, really good in that game. And, yeah, you can tell that the guys who made it are like really having a good time. I played the game a little bit when we were at PAX earlier this year, and I talked to some of the guys there, and I'm like, "So you guys know you made a Sonic the Hedgehog game, right?" And they're like, "Completely." But it was great. I love the game. I can't wait to play more of it. And the level selection is totally scraped from Super Mario World.
Oh, the overworld. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you can tell there's a lot of nice nods to platformers of old.
How's the FMV?
The FMVs are good, actually.
And how's Big the Cat? Is he in there?
No, there actually is FMV in Splosion Man. They shoot like video in their development studio and then put that in the game. It's really, really good.
Now, I know you're a really big fan of this developer.
Mm-hmm.
Are you considering getting a Kinect to play Gunstringer?
My nieces have a Kinect that they never use. I'm going to steal it and play Gunslinger.
Good for you.
Yeah. I'm going to take it from those fucking kids. They don't deserve their money. So I'm gonna take it and play Gunslinger, which was actually really fun. Mike Sklens and I played it at PAX and had a blast with it.
Hmm.
I don't think they should have made it a box game, though. I think it should have stayed a downloadable.
Yeah, I think it's actually the FMV that primarily drove it
onto a
disc, because it was just getting too big for arcade.
Yeah, it's a really cool game, though. It's by far the most accessible Kinect game I've seen. You can actually play it sitting down, which is nice.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
The other game that I want to talk about is very apropos in that it is Shadows of the Damned, which is the latest game from Grasshopper Manufacture, which is, of course, the developer of Killer 7. This is actually a re-team up of Shinji Mikami and Goichi Suda, who first collaborated on Killer 7. Of course, you know Shinji Mikami as the main dude behind Resident Evil 4, which is also apropos because this game is basically Resident Evil 4. Except that you can move when you shoot, which is great. I know Billy talked about it a little bit when he was here, so I guess I'll just sort of give my 2 cents on the game. It's good. It's a good Resident Evil 4 clone. It's solid. But ultimately, I do sort of feel like they cheaped out on the style. I don't feel like it's got that awesome style that No More Heroes had or that Killer 7 had or Michigan had. It's just sort of like, well, it's dudes saying the F word and talking about their dicks a lot, you know, which is fine, all fine and good, but ultimately really wears thin. And
yeah, I mean, it's fine for a podcast, but I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, when I do it, it's cool, but when other people do it, it sounds funny because they just don't know how to do it right. In any case, the issue with it is like, yes, it plays completely serviceably. If you are the kind of person who dislikes Grasshopper Manufacture because you don't think they make quote unquote games well enough, that they don't focus enough on their gameplay, then you will like Shadows of the Damned because it is the most, I guess, traditional game that they've made yet, I guess is the right way to put it. But it's really missing that special spark that I think you find in a lot of Grasshopper games, which is disappointing.
Do you just find it's not weird enough?
Yeah, it's not weird enough. I mean, it's weird, but not good weird. It's just like, this dude has huge nipples. Isn't that weird? Like, not social commentary. Or even dudes jacking off with swords. I can even take that. But, like, the amount of weird in this game is just sort of like, it's a little bit too much wink-wink out of the audience and not actually substantial.
And did you think that No More Heroes was... I've played No More Heroes 1 and 2, so that's my mm-hmm. most exposure to Suda.
Sure.
So do you think it's not as weird as those games?
No, it's not as weird as those games.
Remember in those games you did have a mission where you went and beat up an entire baseball team.
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah. In Killer 7, you fight the Power Rangers. It's great. I don't know if any of you guys got that far except for James.
Yes.
Spoilers.
He ripped it off from Super Mario RPG.
Or Meth Dream, whichever one he was having at the time.
Or the Power Rangers. But in any case, Shadows of the Damned, yeah, it's just like, John, I feel like you would like Shadows of the Damned. You'd probably dig it because it's really traditional and, you know, you like Resident Evil 4, so you'll like that game. But you'll probably hate the game's humor as much as I do, which is to say a lot. So I'm a little disappointed in that way. But the game is still just by its own design solid enough to keep playing it, and I am enjoying it.
So what are your feelings on the, what's the next one? The Lollipop game?
Yeah, I've only read a little bit about it, but I'm curious. You know, I'm always excited to hear about a new Grasshopper game, so I'll give it a shot.
From what I've read, it sounds like the drugs they're getting have possibly spiraled out of control.
And yeah.
There needs to be an intervention staged at that office.
All right, well, Greg's up next with two games I wish I was playing.
Oh, really? Well, first thing I want to follow up on from last week. I do have Gargoyle's Quest. I've downloaded it. We now know it's out in America as well, you know, basically the same day.
And at the end of this show.
But I've had a little bit of time to play that today. Just got past like the first level or whatever. You know, and the first thing, just very superficially, it struck me is it is visually quite impressive for a game from 1990 on the Game Boy. I mean, this is really early Game Boy. You know, I mean, if you think of it like next to something like Super Mario Land, it's almost like it's on a different platform or something. I mean, you know, big sort of detail sprites, some decent animation and stuff. So the presentation wise, it looks pretty cool. And of course, the first thing you're going to notice is the amount of sort of wall clinging and all that kind of as part of the gameplay, which certainly makes you think of Mega Man X, which they went on to make later on for the Super Nintendo. So, but looks really promising.
Well, Greg, I'm glad you compared it to Mega Man X because I was going to do the same thing. I was thinking about this earlier today, but now that Capcom has put out Mega Man X on Virtual Console and they put out Gargoyle's Quest on Virtual Console, I'm really hoping that they're going to carry through this momentum and do Demon's Crest for the Super Nintendo because that game is basically a Mega Man X game, but you're playing a gargoyle.
Yeah, so I understand. Apparently, as well, it's specifically ZX and stuff. It might be even more similar to those games than it is to X, from what some people say. But I mean,
it is.
In terms of the trajectory that we're on with some of these games, it's worth mentioning, I haven't mentioned before, X2 Super Nintendo has been rated by the ESRB.
Yeah.
So I would be expecting that to come fairly soon, probably to Japan first. And then also, don't forget there's a Gargoyle's Quest 2 that was originally released for the NES in 1992. Quite a strange thing that a lot of people seem to think is actually a pretty solid improvement on the Game Boy original, but didn't show up on the Game Boy apart from a port that was Japan exclusive. So it would be kind of weird to kind of start on the 3DS Virtual Console, then hop over to the Wii one for the NES sequel, but not out of the question, I suppose.
And then they can do the Super NES one. Wouldn't that be amazing if they did the whole series? That'd be so
It'd be nice. I'm just glad that Capcom at least seems to be still continuing to support the whole idea of Virtual Console on 3DS and Wii or whatever. You know, like some people like Konami, not so much at this point, even though they've got notable titles still left on the table. But sure. On that subject, I do want to clean something up from last week, the whole Bionic Commando issue. So that was there was a game confirmed, Bionic Commando, Virtual Console game confirmed for Europe in quarter four of this year, but it is not the Game Boy Color one, Elite Forces. It is, in fact, the black and white Game Boy version from about 92, which is like a lot of portable versions of sort of popular series at the time. It's not really a straight port. It's kind of an adaptation, apparently, but it's still heavily based off the NES game, and it's, you know, certain bits of the layouts are kind of replicated and all this kind of stuff. And it also has like a futuristic theme as opposed to the slightly tasteless World War II.
I don't see what's problem here.
That you had in the original.
Yeah, Elite Forces is also a little bit futuristic.
Right, yeah. What's interesting, though, first of all, is that certainly I've heard some good things. Kind of, some people seem to prefer one or the other, but there are fans of both Game Boy Bionic Commando games, so I'd certainly like to see both come out eventually, although it does look like they're kind of sticking to the whole black and white games for a good while yet before we get to any more color ones. I think the Link's Awakening was kind of a one-off seemingly for the time being. But also, the interesting point that I recognized was that the Elite Forces never actually came out in Europe. So I was thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe it'll have to be an import game one day when it comes out. But then I looked into it. Gargoyle's Quest never did either. This is actually an import game, essentially, but without any kind of premium associated with it.
They forgot too, apparently.
So it's quite interesting that we've just sort of had a sort of stealth import game in this case. I mean, maybe if it was something that was actually coming from Japan for the first time, they might have made a deal of it and stuck 100 points on the end. Or maybe they've kind of renounced that practice altogether as part of the eShop.
Well, didn't you pay a premium on Mario RPG?
Yes. Oh, yes. Exactly.
There's a precedent for that, so maybe they're just going to take a different policy altogether for import titles.
Yeah, they may do. It'd be interesting to see how much this is kind of replicated, because I'm sure there's quite a number of high-profile, you know, games from the period that didn't come out in Europe, probably just for various reasons. It was pretty sort of sloppy back then, you know, how things got brought across in a lot of cases. So that's a kind of encouraging sign as well. I'm definitely looking forward to playing more of Gargoyle's Quest next week. But one of the main things I've been playing this week, apart from Killer7, of course, is Minna no Rhythm Tengoku, or everyone's Rhythm Heaven.
That's right, it's not just my Rhythm Heaven.
It's everybody's.
It's everyone's.
Minna no Rhythm Tengoku.
But I don't think it's a misnomer, in the sense that I think this is definitely the most inclusive Rhythm Heaven game yet, from the point of view that, first of all, you do have two-player in it. But I have not yet been able to try it. So it's kind of just been a sort of straight Rhythm Heaven experience for me so far. But it's not like a huge part of the game, seemingly. I mean, it follows the format of the last Rhythm Heaven game for DS pretty much perfectly, from the point of view that it has 50 challenges, 10 of which are remixes, and then the other 40, you've got about 28 games that are sort of unique, and then you've got 12 which are sort of advanced versions of some of the earlier ones. But then, you know, of that sort of 28 unique games, only 8 of those have two-player modes. So it's not a massive sort of chunk of the game, but it looks like it could be fun from what I've seen of like YouTube videos and all that sort of thing. But I just played through the AR by myself. It's been hugely entertaining. I absolutely love these games. I mean, the DS one probably rated a little bit lower than the GBA game.
I agree.
But not by a whole lot. I'm not one of these big detractors of it. I mean, I did have the Western version, the European version specifically, which is called Rhythm Paradise.
Because this game needs different names in
every territory. Yep.
Which, the music maybe wasn't quite as good. In some cases, it was hampered by the localization that kind of went on there, maybe. I mean, I'm not really down on it like some people, but you know, it probably did lose a bit of that charm, you know, so that really sort of gets to the heart of Rhythm Tengoku, is just the wackiness and the Japanese sort of nature of it, for me, sort of embellishes it as much as anything. And so it was nice in this case to get back to that, and also to get back to button controls, which I think really are more appropriate in this. Again, I was not someone who hated the tapping and the flicking and all that with the touchscreen on DS. I wasn't. I got on with it. But what I noticed playing this now was that it just felt like there was a sort of a slight barrier between me and the game, between me and the music and the rhythm, that had been taken away again by just having that more direct and precise input mechanism of the buttons. And in fact, it's simpler than it's ever been, because you only have two inputs that you will ever use, which is A and then A and B together. You know, you sort of pinch the controller to press the two buttons.
Now, Greg, I have a question for you. As someone who's just sort of never got around to playing Rhythm Tengoku in any of its forms, would you say this is the one that I should get?
I think it's a good bet, because, like I said, it's back to the original, and since it might be a bit more precise than the DS one. Yeah, I probably had to fudge it a little bit for the touchscreen.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think it's quite welcoming. It starts off relatively sort of gentle, and as I said, this input mechanism is as simple as could be. I mean, with the GBA one, it was really simple, don't get me wrong, but you did have some that used the D-pad and might use like all the different directions on that, so it was still more complex than this. So it kind of gets down to the real basics of Rhythm Heaven in a way, which is basic in itself. So I think it has got the capacity for broad appeal, and it does in Japan. I mean, it's been riding high at the top of the charts for the past month. The DS game sold extremely well, but at the same time, it has got this sort of hardcore edge to it, you know, when you really get into it, so it can appeal in both ways.
Yeah, I have a bit of an itch that's kind of left over from the last time that I replayed Elite Beat Agents for a good rhythm game, so I think I might pick this one up.
Yeah, it's different from those. I mean,
I know it's different. You know, obviously the input alone is.
In some ways it's simpler. In some ways it's kind of more close to like a traditional game than it is, you know, a classic sort of rhythm game setup. And of course, the unique sort of characteristic of Rhythm Heaven is the way it plays off between the visuals and the music, in terms of, like, you know, this weird relationship, this push and pull between like the visuals helping you understand the rhythm and what you're supposed to do, and then sometimes they just take it away and you're left to just do it based on the music. And much more so in this game than any of the others, they will try and fuck with you with the visuals this time.
Yes. demo, it's perfectly clear they're planning on it.
And I mean, I guess some of it is just because you have, you know, it maintains, of course, the very simple, clean kind of aesthetic that the Rhythm Heaven games have always had, you know, very deliberately basic. But here, because it is on Wii, they still use a lot more kind of fanciness to distract you from what's going on. Like, I mean, there's a few things that are really kind of funny almost. I mean, sometimes they just try and distract you with something that is funny. But I mean, there's one game that I really like where you're playing like a monkey that's on the end of what appears to be a giant clock hand, and he's high-fiving all these other little monkeys as the hand cycles through the clock. But then just in the middle of the game, all of a sudden the camera zooms way out and it's actually just a tiny little wristwatch on the screen. And of course the music doesn't change, what you're doing doesn't change, but it's like, fuck, what? You know, and it just screws with you, totally throws you off.
Yeah, I know in the demo they had the airplane tennis game where suddenly you're in the clouds and you couldn't see shit. All you saw were just clouds.
Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of, at that point, you almost have to kind of see through the television, if you know what I mean, rather than...
just don't look.
But that's the thing, I think it's, not only have you got this situation where the graphics are more complicated, or they do more fancy kind of effects and things because it's on Wii, but also because it's on a big TV rather than a portable, I think they're just intrinsically more effective in throwing you off, because you can't escape escape them quite so easily. I mean, you could always close your eyes altogether. I think that'd be sort of denying a big part of the fun. Just trying to sort of deal with them. And sometimes they are just really funny. This one where you're kind of, I think it's a remix, you're trading back and forth between the games and it keeps going back to the Karate Man, you know, the classics of Rhythm Heaven staple of the guy just punching all these things that are thrown at him. And there's one where you're going back and forth and then it just goes back to the Karate Man and he's just lying down watching TV and nothing happens and it just cuts back to something else. Or, you know, these little things are just, you know, not so much even the dazzling kind of quality of the clouds or this, that, but just gags. Like there's a baseball one where you see this lady is kind of lobbing balls up to be hit out of the park. And then at the very end, like, pretty much like one action short of the end, they sort of pull this curtain up and show that she wasn't actually throwing the balls to him directly. She was throwing it to a monkey to throw the ball to him. You know, just this bizarre stuff that makes no sense to put you off. You know, that it's, to me, that is really the magic of Rhythm Heaven, is this sort of, well, the visuals don't matter really, but yet they do so much. And that's much more vibrant and alive than it's ever been in any of the other two for me. So it's the same thing. If you've played one of the other two before and you didn't like it, I struggled to see how this would convert you, really. But the fact that now it's, you know, on a big TV, the music sounds better than ever because it's not compressed or anything like that, you know, quite a lot of vocal stuff, that could be a challenge for the localization team. So you've got that to consider again.
They've committed, though.
They have committed, I think, but you know, it could be, you know, in terms of how good those songs sound when they come over.
Right.
We'll wait and see on that. But the fact that you've got it on the big TV, I guess that's the thing in terms of the inclusivity point now. I think it'd just be funny for people to watch someone playing this game.
Oh, it's hilarious. I mean, firsthand, I can tell you it's the funniest thing in the world.
So, that, again, with a portable, that's not really a factor. So I think actually, even though it doesn't use like a lot of the main headline features of the Wii, and the multiplayer isn't a huge part of it, but it is there, it seems like this is actually a really good fit for the Rhythm Tengoku formula. And finally, it does have what I consider to be the best Rhythm Tengoku game concept ever, which is the wrestler interview.
Yes.
It's amazing. It's like this little reporter asking this giant masked wrestler sort of questions, and you either sort of grunt approvingly, do a sort of bicep flex, or do a ridiculous pose for the photographers.
Yes.
And it's so infectiously catchy with the music, and it's just completely absurd. It typifies what the whole Rhythm Tengoku experience is all about for me. So, been very, very pleased with this.
Now, if you like smooth moves, how do you think you'd like this?
It's some of the same appeal. I mean, obviously, these are like songs and stuff, so it's not quite as hectic as WarioWare. I mean, maybe some of the latter remix stages kind of capture that WarioWare-ness the most, whereas you're flitting between any number of the previous games mixed together. You know, that kind of has some of the same frenetic quality. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's a bit less crazy. But obviously, with WarioWare, smooth moves, I mean, there's not a huge multiplayer component. A lot of that is like passing the remote and stuff. You know, it's just, it'd be the same sort of atmosphere, I think, of just watching people indulge in silly stuff.
It's the same kind of comedy, but based on very limited experience, it seems like the person playing is more locked in than they were in WarioWare, because they are playing it versus they're playing it for like 10 seconds and then throwing it at somebody.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be locked in. I mean, you will be, you know, tapping your foot or nodding your head. You have to be, you know, this is the only way you're going to pass these games is if you get yourself locked. So I think that creates comedy potential for the point.
Oh, yeah, because you're totally unaware of how stupid you look playing it, but everybody else is very much aware.
Yeah. So I think that's what you could, well, when it does eventually get here, if there's anybody left buying Wii games, that it could well find a bit, maybe a bigger audience than it had on DS, because even with the big push with Beyonce and all that, didn't do as well as they were hoping on DS.
Yeah, It sounds like something I could probably play with my wife. We're big fans of smooth moves. She loves smooth moves, so it sounds very
similar. She loves the smooth moves, huh?
She does. Silky smooth moves, obviously, if you will.
Everyone saw that one hanging, and everyone was like, you know what, not going to take it. And then James is like, it's all from me.
Yeah, this is the first Rhythm Heaven game that I'm really interested in because it's on a console, and not for any of the reasons that Greg said, you know, about the button controls or the higher quality music. But for me, I just don't like the ergonomics of playing a really difficult, tense rhythm game on a handheld.
Yeah.
And I love Uundan and Elite Beat Agents, but those games were at times very uncomfortable for me to play because they are challenging and you're playing them on this tiny little screen. And I get really tense when I play a game like that, and I don't want to be hunched over a little handheld while I do it. Mm. And it's hard for me to get into a good position where I have to like put it on a flat surface so it's stable and reliable, which means that I'm basically like hunched over a table while I play this, which is not really how I want to play a DS.
Yeah, being able to sit back and like playing on a huge TV is like a big thing.
Yeah, and not worry about where my hands are pointed or, you know,
sure.
That's a big deal for me. So this is much more appealing to me than, it's one reason I always hope they do an Elite Beat Agents on Wii, even though I think the controls would be difficult to translate.
Yeah.
I do think it would have been, it would have solved that problem. It might have created other problems.
So what's interesting is, if you all will indulge me for a moment.
That's all I do.
This afternoon, well, this morning, I had a conference call with Natsume about their remaining lineup for this year. And one of the games we discussed was I'm not going to say it's an Uundan knockoff, but when I played it at E3 2009, the game Gabrielle's Ghostly Groove seemed like, I mean, it played just like Uundan. But they basically took that game off the DS and moved it to the 3DS. And because they put it on the top screen, they had to resolve the situation of mapping the controllers when you're not looking at what's going on. Because obviously you can't touch screen the top screen. They didn't want to waste that top screen with nothing. So what they did is they took the same general gameplay, but they emphasized more the rhythm and the making the motions, which is on the screen, rather than where you actually do them.
That sounds like Rhythm Heaven DS.
Well, to an extent, but it's still motions like the kind that you had in Uundan, but it's just not so concerned about where you do them on the screen.
It could be this year's Horse Life.
I was thinking it was going to be
didn't
more.
Didn't that just get pushed back because another victim of the 3DS's slow start?
So actually, that was where I found out it got pushed back, which is where the story came.
It was on the call, yeah.
Yeah, so it was originally supposed to already be out. It's been done for a while. They pushed it back to October along with Harvest Moon 3DS, which is the same game as Harvest Moon DS, which isn't pushed back. But they pushed both games back to October. They felt that one Gabrielle better fits to Halloween anyway.
Yeah, there's no competition in October.
And yeah, I know. Well,
no whatsoever.
You know, they did touch on that. They said they're not really worried about the other games. That they make games for a niche, and they know that niche is there for them. So
yeah, I don't think there's a lot of crossover between those two user bases.
They're just worried that their niche will have a 3DS by the time they come out.
Basically, and to discuss their niche, 63% of people who play Harvest Moon are female.
Sure.
And their median age is 29.
Cool. Well, James, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about this week?
So I did put more time into Enslaved. So I was actually discussing this game with a friend of mine who she went through a computer graphics program at one of the actual schools that does video game design, not, you know, one of those mail order schools. And it came up because we were discussing The Spirits Within because we were looking for a terrible movie to watch. And we decided that didn't qualify.
Yeah, I don't think Spirits Within is nearly as bad as people think it is.
We ended up settling on an Italian cartoon about the Titanic.
That'll probably fit the bill.
Should have watched Sucker Punch, man.
1.5 on IMDb. 1.5.
That's terrible.
But we brought up video of the actual movie, and we were looking at images of it. And what I found is that the faces actually don't even look as good as the faces in the in-game engine of Enslaved. It's kind of stunning to think about where we've come from in, what, 9 years? In terms of gameplay, that game, it feels a little like it's getting stretched out on me now. A lot of times you'll go into what essentially amounts to a kill room, and four of the bastards in there have shields on, which means they're infinitely more difficult to deal with because you have to get behind them or disable the shield. And meanwhile, the other three are pounding you in the head with sticks. There's maybe a bit too much of that sometimes, so what I felt is that I can't marathon this game like I can most. I play it for an hour or so, and then I set it down and go, okay, I'm more or less done at this point right now. Maybe get through one or two chapters. I think I've got about three chapters left at this point.
Welcome to my world, James. That's how I play. That's how I play pretty much everything now. For me, a marathon is I played three games today. I mean, I might play for 6 hours on a really good marathon day. I might play a lot of video games, but that's not all the same game. There's no way. I almost never play a game for that long.
Well, what I've found, though, is that when the game does do something different, when it decides to mix things up, it's way better. Like, they could have cut out some of the superfluous fighting, and I know that it adds tension to the game, but the combat just doesn't feel that fun after a while. It doesn't feel diverse enough to really give it much excitement, but the other stuff, I mean, just the regular combat, the boss battles are always relatively interesting. Yeah, some of them are kind of broken, but they're at least interesting. The stuff on the cloud can be fun or frustrating depending on the particular scenario. There was a boss battle against a thing called the Rhino, which was really fun. But the stage getting to the Rhino was just walking over pipes and then beating robots about the head for a while. if they had just cut to me in the room with the Rhino, even if the game would have been shorter, I would have been happier. It's kind of a weird situation, but I'm kind of ready for this game to take me to wherever it wants to go because I know it's going to be awesome. I just kind of wish it would just go ahead and get there.
Okay, well, the rest of us, meaning John and I, don't really have any new business this week. It was a maintenance week for me, so other than Killer 7, I also made a lot of progress on various games that I've talked about before because I'm trying to actually finish some of these. I really want to finish things like Ghost Trick and and Outland, and I'm getting a lot closer on some of these, but I haven't actually finished enough to start a new game.
I play a little bit more Mass Effect and
a little bit more.
I mean, that's kind of going to be a long term thing.
Actually, so you've only got about 80 hours of Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2 left.
Now, the one thing that I haven't really played too much of, but actually I got this a couple of weeks ago, was Pixel Junk Shooter 2.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Just, you know, I've kind of heard some good things about it, and I was kind of curious. It was on sale for some cheap price on PSN, so I figured I'd pick it up.
You know, I have not played any online co-op in that game, and I would like to.
Yeah.
So let's arrange that. It's a date.
It's a play date. Johnny and I have a play date.
All right. So since John and I didn't have much new business, we thought we'd pull in a little bit of discussion here to round out new business. And it has to do with rumors. We do this occasionally. And there were certainly some very interesting 3DS rumors that hit this week thanks to a site called 01Net, which is a French site, but they offer English translations of their big articles. And this actually ties in really nicely with an email that we got from Sergeant Foster in Japan. And since we're not doing listener mail this week, we're doing retroactive instead. We thought we could pull in this little email from Sergeant Foster and kick off a little brief discussion on the new 3DS rumors. So he wrote, "I have a question for you gentlemen and all of your infinite wisdom, and James too, if he's there. With the current situation of the 3DS and how sales may or may not experience a true upswing after the price drop, do you think Nintendo still has plans to redesign the 3DS system? If so, then what iterations do you foresee? Of course, some things are automatic, like the battery and how DS games look on the system. I would like to see a drastic take that would bring the price back up, but pack in more tech. I'd like to see the following. Capacitive touchscreen, larger and equal size screens, the same size as an XL. More RAM so engines don't take such a hit when having to render 3D images. More internal storage. And then these two are from Crazy Land, but 6 face buttons and dual circle pads." Well, there's a lot to comment on there. There's some fun ideas in there. But before we get to that, I want to say that was the first thing we saw. And then a couple days later, the rumors came out from 01Net, and they claim to have a source within Nintendo, etc. They've been doing a whole series on articles about Nintendo this week and some weird stuff about Wii U and Mario Galaxy and other things. But for the sake of this, we'll focus on the 3DS rumors that they put out. And that is that, first off, there will be a second analog stick or pad, circle pad, will be sold as a roughly $10 accessory for the current 3DS model. Like a strap-on.
Well, they don't know how it would mount yet, let's put it that way.
Well, it's not going in the DS slot or the GBA slot.
Yes. Well, I mean, even then, how would you put it? I mean, it would do it to like wrap around the side. Yeah, they don't.
I can't see that happening.
Yeah. So before, well, let me get to the other two before we start commenting. But second, there's still a long waiting list for developers to purchase 3DS development kits, which are very expensive. And a lot of developers really don't have enough or haven't been able to get one yet, even though they want one. And finally, 01net, or at least their source, claims that there will be a new 3DS model in 2012, possibly without 3D.
Yeah, this is where the language really gets.
Yeah, kind of, that was a translation.
It's because when they're talking about drastically reduced or this that about 3D, or do they mean in the emphasis? Would it be remarketed? Could it actually be an iteration of the 3DS that's not even called the 3DS anymore? That it'd be rebranded altogether, or would it actually be some sort of technical thing, like the actual the screen would be different, and you know, maybe because they don't care so much about the 3D, or they don't think the market cares so much about 3D as they originally thought, or so that's very unclear. There's a lot of ambiguity to read into.
I would say their official translation, because they did release an official translation. It puts it more on the realm of a much reduced 3D in terms of the push of the system. That the term 3D might not even be in a rebrand.
And we've already seen them kind of going in that direction already.
Well, and they just launched an ad campaign this week in the US that's basically the same thing. It shows Zelda and then all the games coming out this year and then says the new price.
Which is great. I mean, I don't think they should totally ignore 3D in the marketing, but I think they also need the commercials that focus on games.
Right. Yeah. They sort of tacitly discuss the 3D, but they don't actually go and like then it's in 3D. Look at this, there's 3D everywhere.
Yeah. Well, we always knew that the 3D part of it would probably be an upfront gimmick. Like if that sold anyone on the system, it would be only be near the beginning, because the technology will not be that novel for very long.
No.
And also Nintendo couldn't have predicted this, but people are souring on 3D anyway. It's not really a very favorable technology right now in the public conscience. So they need to focus on these other things anyway, and they were going to have to do it eventually. They might be doing it earlier than they ever imagined, but this is not a surprise. I mean, we knew eventually it's all about the games. It's all about what the system can do to make your games better. And 3D is marginal in that way. It's not worthless, but it's marginal. And this is old topic for us. So anyway, I think the circle pad stuff is really crazy, because I mean, Sergeant Foster said, well, this is from crazy land. And then the 01net, that's the first thing they drop. And I have a very, very difficult time believing that this could even be discussed.
Yeah, their source they claim to have is a Nintendo source itself, and basically according to the discussion in the document, is that one thing they thought when they released it was, well, the dual analog is not particularly important, and then immediately they had second thoughts. We're like, oh, we were so wrong.
Well, here's the thing, it's not that important.
It's not.
Yeah, it's really odd to me. I really can't imagine that Nintendo themselves, strictly in terms of making their own games, would ever have that kind of U-turn on something this, you know, sort of intrinsic to the hardware that they've made so quickly. The only plausible explanation I could imagine, and I'm not buying in yet, is something about Vita coming along with the dual sticks, and apparently it's easy to develop for, and they've made the kits easy to buy and all this kind of stuff. Just going to one of the other points that Zero-One has brought up, that you know they feel like they have to do it as some sort of olive branch to the third parties in Japan, lest they sort of, you know, abandon ship altogether. But you know, that's what's going to make TGS this year really interesting to watch.
It will be.
You know, the between the two portable systems, of Vita still being on the horizon, of course, but there's going to be a lot of games talked about. I've already seen some announcements this week, and some that are on both platforms.
Yep.
So that duel that's going to happen at TGS is going to be very interesting. And of course, what we have now confirmed, which was sort of hinted at by some of these rumors and things, is that Nintendo will have a pre-TGS conference of some sort with major announcements to make at it. But I mean, the idea to me that at this press conference, and apparently the you know their stock price surged quite a few points on this news, But the idea to me that they would announce the revision of the 3DS that we've all been expecting from day one. I mean, we all sure. know this is going to happen. And when we talked about the price drop, I said it just makes it even more inevitable that they are going to go to a model where they can increase the price back up a little bit and get a more favorable margin again. But the idea that this early into the price drop's effect, that they would announce the new revision, possibly with a second analog pad that makes it drastically different.
It seems a little silly.
It would undercut any momentum that they've started to build in the aftermath of the price cut. Seems very far-fetched to me.
Yeah. The reason I pushed for the site to make sure we cover this thoroughly is that this site in particular just has a very good track record, and they seemed very willing to stake their record on this particular rumor. I don't take any particular thought on this.
I could see it maybe being for like a large scale Nintendo game, like one that Nintendo is going to pump up.
I am of the mind that what they're saying is not based in Fantasyland. That at some level, this conversation has to have happened within that company, because they've been they've been right on too many things for this just to be completely wrong.
Yeah.
Although there was the recent case, I think it was Zero1 that floated the whole possibility of Vita having its RAM cut in half, which has proven to be false. But again, it may reflect a conversation that happened within Sony that ultimately did not materialize.
Or Sony was ratting out people trying to figure out who was...
the barium meal of rumors. I mean, that could be the source of it, that this is something that they had discussed as part of the 3DS rescue package at one point that may or may not ever really materialize in fact. But September, whatever they've got planned to announce, next month, in a few weeks' time ahead of TGS, it can't be anything to me that's going to undercut the 3DS like that. In fact, what it has to do is bolster it. It's got to be some sort of major announcement of software for me that may be coming, in the earlier part of your first half 2012. Something big, maybe something of their own, or maybe something that they're partnering with a third party, maybe like a Monster Hunter kind of deal. You think that's got to happen at some point. That to me would be what you're looking at in that event.
I don't have enough to write anything on yet, but there is a Square Enix announcement coming soon.
I would think that there has to be. I mean,
when I mean coming soon, I mean like the same couple of days before TGS.
Yeah, because all they have now lined up is Heroes of Ruin, right?
Well, there's Kingdom Hearts 3D, but that's...
They have the, was it Theat Rhythm, the Final Fantasy rhythm game?
Yeah, Theat Rhythm.
But it doesn't seem you're kind of like... Where are the big franchises? So there must be some sort of, Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, something's going on there. I agree, James.
Well, again, they got Rocket Slime again, but it's spin-off type stuff.
Yeah.
There is a major... Well, first off, the next Dragon Quest game is either going to be shown in the next 6 months or is not going to be on the Wii.
Yeah, now is the time.
But if it was on Wii development, and we've already seen this with Rodea the Sky Soldier, it would be very easy to port it to 3DS. I could see them if money was involved, and I could see right now Nintendo being willing to drop that cash, them putting it on the 3DS, and just saying, we have enough faith in this platform after Dragon Quest IX that this game will do for us for a long time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are about a handful of publishers who have known for a long time Nintendo's plans after they immediately determined the 3DS wasn't doing as well. Like, I wouldn't be shocked at all if I found out that Square Enix knew the exact day Nintendo was going to announce a price cut months in advance.
Well, I don't think the decision was made that far in advance, but I think they knew as soon as Nintendo made the decision, because Nintendo did that for the publishers, not for the consumers.
And it wouldn't surprise, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if that announcement is something like Dragon Quest X is on the 3DS.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of major franchises like that where it's kind of like you don't really know necessarily where they're going to land, but it could shift the landscape considerably. Like, where's the next Monster Hunter going to come out? Is it going to be Vita? Is there going to be something for 3DS?
There, I would guess, and this is based on what I know. And based on what I could infer, I would say it's more likely this is a third-party showcase than anything.
That would be great.
Well, that's what makes sense to kind of put it as a lead into TGS, because that is, you know, what happens at TGS. Nintendo, they do things around TGS sometimes, but it's not usually their thing. So it would make the most sense if it was a that kind of partnership.
It is an industry-only event that Nintendo's throwing compared to TGS, which is opened off madhouse of crazy.
Yeah, TGS is mostly public. There is usually a press day.
There is a press day, and then it's just full-on orgy of insanity.
So I just to go back to the dual circle pad thing, I say forget it. I'm not saying it was never considered, but the logistics of actually making that happen, especially as an add-on. I mean, I think even the prospect of whatever the 3DS revision is, whenever that comes down the line, which I think is still a ways out, even when that comes out, I don't think it's going to have two circle pads.
I've sat there and with the 3DS sitting on a notepad and tried to draw what it would look like, and I just can't. I mean,
it's just beside the point. They'll never get anybody to develop for it. And
no. It would literally have to come bundled with every game that supported it, meaning you'd have like a stack of these fucking things sitting on a table somewhere.
Yeah, it's Motion Plus all over again, and that did not work out well.
I mean, look at the PSP, right? Like, look at the PSP where it had just the one analog stick, and people have pretty much hated that for years and years and years, but...
But not in Japan, because they don't give a fuck.
Yeah, and they never, and they've had several iterations of that 1000, 2000, 3000 go... None of them have ever put another nub on there.
Exactly, because that ship has sailed. The 3DS, you're looking at it.
Yeah, but look, the reason that they never did it is because the only people who cared about PSP were in Japan, and Japanese developers and Japanese gamers do not care about having twin joysticks. Look at Monster Hunter. They do not care. The only reason they added second joystick for Vita is that American developers wanted it.
And that's where they need to improve.
The Uncharted guys want it. The first-person shooter guys want it. But the Japanese games, show me a Japanese game that makes good use of twin joysticks.
Well, that doesn't mean that Monster Hunter doesn't need twin joysticks.
No.
It may not use them on all platforms, but it sure as hell needs dual sticks.
Yes, I would agree. It needs more sticks, actually, after playing it on Wii. It needs as many sticks as you can get it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the whole twin joystick thing, the idea that this would be a major concern among Japanese developers, forget it. They do not care about twin joysticks.
It doesn't really pass muster with me. I mean, I think with this whole redesign thing, as I said, we know it's going to happen. The question is, when is it going to happen? How drastic is it going to be?
Right.
And if you look at stuff like the SP, the DS Lite, playbook, you can make some really kind of significant changes in terms of how appealing the hardware is without anything in like circle pads or RAM or internal storage or any of that kind of stuff. So that's what we're expecting, is something in that ballpark. But the wild card is, how well does the 3DS do in the holidays? I think that's going to be the key.
I think it's going to clean up.
You start the clock on this revision stuff after this holiday season is done.
Yeah.
And they're going to look at it, they're gonna look how much momentum they've got, how much money they're pulling in after all the currency losses and all this kind of stuff, how much do they need to improve their margin, this, that, and the other, and then they're going to say, right, what do we need to do in a revision? And if it's the case that the 3DS actually really underperforms, then you could look at a scenario where maybe they would dump the 3DS brand and release, an iterative
Game Boy. Bring back Game Boy.
Bring back Game Boy.
No.
Whatever it would be. And try and sort of just relaunch it essentially with a new model that would be, a bit sleeker and have a better screen or better battery life and all the kind of things that you would expect. Anything outside of that though, capacitive touchscreen, these things that more fundamentally change the interface, the sorts of games that you'd be dealing with, and the whole splitting the market connotations that certainly Nintendo pre-Motion Plus didn't want to get into, that would only, I think, be basically a doomsday scenario,
right,
where they're pretty much moving on from the 3DS altogether.
The 4DS.
The price cut wouldn't have saved it in that scenario.
DS7.
I think capacitive touchscreen is actually a reasonable thing that could actually be done in the 3DS, because you can make that completely backwards compatible with DS software.
You can, sure, but it's the thing about it is like, first of all, capacitive styli are way more expensive than just a stick.
Yeah, well, and it's there's more than that, though. You have to deal with the forwards compatibility of existing hardware. You're
exactly, yeah.
Going to say that every person who's bought a 3DS already now, guys, you're screwed again. You're screwed twice. Take yeah. that.
No. What I'm saying is they can put a capacitive touchscreen on it and run a firmware that translates your inputs on that into the pressure-sensitive touchscreen, because it's just XY coordinates. That's all the DS sees.
But then what's
well, yeah, what's the point then?
What's the point?
It's difficult to justify on a cost basis there. Yeah.
Maybe so.
Unless you're going to start applying things like multi-touch to the equation, there's no right. reason to go capacitive.
I mean, when we're in a situation where they apparently not have it in Wii U, at least
yeah,
not
that's
yet,
a much bigger problem.
Like, and that's yeah. a whole new platform, and yeah. it's a big bloody thing, and all that. I mean, that, you know, it really tells you about where their priorities are on cost and functionality.
It's completely ridiculous that in 2012, or whenever they released this freaking console, that I am using something that basically has a comparative screen to a Palm Trio from the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. On that's Wii U, it's completely unreasonable for them to be using a pressure-sensitive screen. And it's a big problem. Like, it was a noticeable issue at E3.
Yeah.
So they really need to fix that. Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to mention is something that, first off, larger screens, they might be larger, but they're going to be in proportion to each other. They're going to be in the same screen size ratio as on the current 3DS. So they might get closer to an XL size. Not that.
You don't want that.
they won't be that big. They just won't be. But you're not going to get two screens that are the same size.
No, it's the same issue we were discussing earlier for its compatibility of the hardware.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They're not going to add more RAM unless they add new features that can only be done with new RAM like they did for DSi. Yeah.
And they didn't do that much.
Ultimately, it was kind of pointless. I think they did it because it was just as cheap to include to do more RAM.
It might have been cheaper to get the more RAM. It might have actually been more difficult to find RAM that was a smaller amount.
Yeah, but I mean, it allowed them to do things like the home screen and the browser, but that is the only way they would add more RAM. It wouldn't be usable to the games.
No.
And they're not going to fix the DS emulator.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say is that if the screens get bigger, then when you do the pixel for pixel mode, it'll look crisp, but you'll have a bigger area. So, because at the moment, when you do pixel for pixel mode, it is very small. For certain games, it's not great. You know, especially like an action game, something where you know, imagine Contra 4 with all those bullets flying around. But if you've got, as we said, I don't see XL size screens coming anytime soon. But bigger screens means the pixel for pixel mode would be more workable. So that would be nice.
I kind of want to go throw a Red Hot Rumble in there. Not Red Hot Rumble, the Ghost Trick. DS game. I meant Ghost Tricks. Beautiful Joe DS game.
Double Trouble.
Oh, Double Trouble from... Oh, yeah. That probably looks awful.
I bet that looks horrifying. I kind of want to do that under the break.
It is that... You know, I think this TGS coming up now is just going to be... I mean, TGS in the last few years has been pretty snore-worthy for Nintendo fans. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's because the DS has been kind of winding down. But this year is just going to be completely fascinating, even when it is, you know, with the competition with Vita and stuff. It's a big one because, you know, with the way the portables are in Japan and all that, and you could say this about the way the DS succeeded as well. The market is very different, as we know, with the difference between the PSP success in Japan and everywhere else, but I think for Nintendo, the Japanese performance is going to be a bellwether for everywhere else, and it has been doing better in Japan, the situation currently stands, the 3DS. So they're on track for, you know, hopefully a sort of comeback in Japan. But then on the other hand, the competition from Sony is more robust in Japan. Mm-hmm. So you've got a real kind of showdown brewing this year. They do need something big, and it seems like they've got something they think is big for that 15th of September or whatever it is event. So I look forward very much to see what it is.
I'm actually in a way almost looking forward to later in October, the level 5 vision or level 5 world, whatever they call it.
Yeah, they're getting too big for TGS now, aren't they?
they're not even going to be there. They are literally not going to be at TGS because they're throwing all their eggs behind their own event, which they had an event last year, but they were at TGS.
Yeah, and they had a lot of 3DS stuff at that, and it'd be interesting to see the sort of dichotomy between last year and this year.
I'm curious how much of a... Because, I mean, they did actively support Sony systems. I'm curious if that's going to become almost a proxy war in that particular handheld situation because
it could be. I mean, they didn't support PSP very much.
No,
they have supported PS3 and PS2 as yes. well. They had a number of pretty big PlayStation games over the past.
That could
years.
Be a very interesting day for both. I mean, obviously the companies know what Level 5 is cooking up, but it would be very interesting to be an analyst at that particular event because they're one of the few companies right now in Japan that can kind of play Kingmaker.
All right, people. Well, that's going to wrap up new business. It was a pretty wide-ranging segment. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll get into Retroactive with Killer 7 and Carl 7.
We're still in a tight spot, boss.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
So starting with the review section, we've got Neil's review of Cartoon Network Punch Time Explosion, and that's going to be on the 3DS, as well as the Wii version of Phineas and Ferb Across the Second Dimension by our good buddy Scott Thompson.
And closing out our reviews this week, we have a pair of 3D classics reviews from James Dawson with Xevious and Urban Champion. And continuing the retro tip, we also have VC recommendations from JP and Andrew on baseball and Marius Picross, respectively.
Kind of unfair to call Urban Champion a classic.
There have been numerous cases of people taking issue with that particular naming.
We have impressions of Kirby's Return to Dreamland from Aaron, which is a Kirby game.
Well, and we now know that game you can actually have four people playing as Kirby, not just one.
Four people can play as Kirby, which means that not everyone has to play with a crappy character.
That's right.
We also have a feature, the first Super Nintendo memories from various members of the staff, where they write about their first memories of playing the Super Nintendo.
All right. On the blog front, we have from JP Corbin a tale of his ability to see 3D for the first time after having his eye operated on, I believe. And it's called Seeing in Three Dimensions for the First Time. And then we also have impressions for Tekken 3D Prime Edition from Don.
Apparently it was his game of the show at Gamescom.
Yes.
So read about it. And it has a 3D CG movie packed in with it as well.
All right. Well, finally this week, we've got a preview. That's with a P. A preview.
What?
Of Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor Overclocked. Maybe the first RPG for 3DS. And we've got hands-on impressions, yet again, of Zelda Skyward Sword. And this time, Carly played the demo that was basically from E3, also shown at Gamescom. But she played it pretty much as far as you could possibly play it. So she actually discovered elements of it that you probably haven't read about anywhere else.
Yeah, she pushed it to the limit.
All right, well, that's all the great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Just in the past week, there's been even more posted since we recorded this, so definitely go check it out. Welcome back to Radio Free Nintendo. You know, every couple of months here on the podcast, we ask our listeners to help us select a game to play, a classic game perhaps, or an overlooked game, or a misunderstood game often.
And once again, you have failed democracy.
But this time, we sort of had a theme of GameCube titles. And the game that came out on top was quite surprisingly, for me personally, I really didn't think this would
really?
Be... I didn't think this would be a contender. So it is always interesting.
I thought it would have a decent support, but it didn't just win. It won
it demolished.
Convincingly. I think it is, whatever you want to say, I think it is an affirmation of the audience's enduring love for Carl, because they knew this would happen.
Yep.
Like it would get Carl back on the show.
Yeah, they would conjure him out of thin air.
This is your legacy, Carl. Enjoy
Killer
it.
Killer 7, Killer 7, Killer 7, and Carl appears. Say that three times
into
a mirror.
I love the idea that Carl is someone for whom the verb conjure applies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the object of that transitive verb, conjure. Not many people can say that.
This is the odd thing about me and Killer 7 is that, you know...
I actually hate the game.
No, I fucking didn't even play it, honestly. I wrote that review based on nothing. There's your big fucking surprise, fellas.
I rolled some dice, came up with a 9. That's what happens.
No. The weird thing about Killer 7 is that people, like, in the comment section were like, this game's been discussed to death by Carl on the show, which is not true. I reviewed that game before Radio Free Nintendo even started, and even then, I maybe mentioned it in passing a couple times. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever really been a game that's been discussed on the show. It's been disparaged.
No, not the actual game, the running joke.
Yeah, the running joke that it's a game that I enjoy and thusly must be disparaged at all costs. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's a bizarre game, and I understand when people have their opinions about it. I personally enjoy it.
I don't think the issue, for me at least, and the people I know who played it, is that it's bizarre. I think that's its grace, is that it's utterly bizarre. I think generally speaking, the biggest critique I've always heard, and the one that I've always felt, is that it plays like a bad Flash game.
That's an opinion that people hold, sure.
I don't think anybody's issue with the game is that it's weird. I think...
Yeah, I don't think... You're probably right, James. I think that's a fair point.
Well, but then in gameplay terms, it is contrarian. Shall we say you could look at it as being weird in that sense.
It could be done as a Flash game. I would say that.
Well, the mechanic of shooting is very simplified, and the fact that you don't really have control, you don't really have free roaming control of your character. Yeah. You can only basically move forward and backward along the line.
It's on the rails, and then you choose paths at juncture points.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I prefer this to what we usually refer to as an on-rail shooter when the game moves forward and directs where you can look. I definitely prefer this style of it, where you do actually control your movement forward or backward, and you also... I think we'll get into this, but one of my issues is that the game still asks you to explore, which is not a good marriage with the control style. I think the way the game controls would make more sense if it was actually more linear than it actually is.
I agree. Mm.
There are some times where the on rail the game feels like, well, this is where the camera should be, and then suddenly you're like, no, I'm just looking at my feet. Can we turn the camera the other way so I can see where the fuck I'm running?
Yep.
No. Yeah. Oh, I've just been killed by Heaven's Smile. Thank you, game.
Well, I mean, we should probably set it up before we begin.
Yeah, wind it back a little.
Before the assault starts. And I'm actually just going to read the, I think honestly the best sum up of it is just like a couple sentences on the Wikipedia page. The game follows an elite group of assassins called the Killer Seven. The assassins, physical manifestations of one man, Harmon Smith, performs hits on behalf of the United States government. Through these missions, the Killer Seven uncover a deeper conspiracy regarding the role of Japan in U.S. politics and secrets about the nature of their organization.
Yeah, also, that Wikipedia page references Carl specifically with a horrific quote that says, some people criticize the shooting gameplay, but Carl Castaneda in the Nintendo World Report said it was still fun.
Wow.
Check the edit on that page. Check the edit.
Not only is it Carl said, this was still fun.
Killer7Carl@gmail.com said.
CarlSmith@gmail.com.
Carl Smith. I like that.
I found recently that I'm actually located on a few weird game Wikipedia entries. I'm also on Crash Tag Team Racing, for example.
<Jesus Christ. laughs> So Killer 7 is a very odd take on a survival horror, perhaps, or maybe a first-person shooter, but with very twisted kind of mechanics from the mind of Suda 51, Goichi Suda, who, of course, is responsible for Shadows of the Damned, which Carl talked about earlier. Also, No More Heroes, both of them, on the Wii and now on PS3 as well. And Flower, Sun, and Rain.
Yes, which this game feels horrifyingly close to now that I'm playing it in retrospect.
I think Flower, Sun, and Rain is a lot more frustrating than this than Killer 7.
There are some parallels that I did not pick up when I played Flower, Sun, and Rain that I've got
Dude,
when I went back.
You try playing Michigan, then you get back to me on how frustrating Killer 7 is.
First off, the game's called Michigan, so no, I'm not going to fucking play it.
Well, look, Killer 7's it's an odd blend of some people have called it first-person adventure, as well as like a semi-on-rails adventure game.
But it's not.
I don't agree that it's a first-person adventure, because the only part where you're in first person is when you're shooting people, so it's hardly a first-person adventure, but it's been called that. And so there are puzzle elements, and then obviously some really, really, I think, creative boss fights. But When Johnny asked me to be on, and first of all, he announced that I would be on before asking me, first of all.
That's right.
It's the Smash Brothers brawl approach. Like, yeah, we're going to have a Smash Brothers. We haven't asked Sakurai about it, but he's good for it, you know.
No, I believe I discussed this with Carl even when it was in the poll, just in case.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was never going to not come on and, you know.
and we very much appreciate your presence and your eagerness to defend Killer7 from the assaults, which we haven't really begun.
I have note cards with various answers to various questions you might have, or assaults, or concerns.
Prepared responses.
One thing I'd like to provide as context as well is that, you know, perhaps some of our younger listeners or whatever might be under the impression that Carl is the only person that gave this game a very favorable review, which is certainly not the case. It generally got decent reviews, as you might imagine. It's quite polarizing. Some people didn't like it and gave it low scores, but it got quite a lot of good reviews, and some just as high in their praise as Carl.
It's true.
Yeah, you might remember that Matt Casamassina rated it as one of the most underrated games on the GameCube.
Johnny sounds super enthused.
Response to that.
And this wasn't a review, but the game guide that I've been using to play through it, just to eliminate frustration. I'll talk about that later, but the game guide that I've been using is from GameSpot, and that was written by Matt Rory, who's now over at Whiskey Media with Screened, and still does a little bit of game stuff with Giant Bomb. And he, from what I can tell in the guide, he seems to like it. I don't think he reviewed it. I think someone else reviewed it for GameSpot, but I know that GameSpot did give it a high review at that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's not prejudice the discussion overly much with some sort of belief that this is some ridiculed game, because it certainly is not.
Elements of it are, and I think that they're earned.
It's a bit of a running gag on Radio Free Nintendo, but I think that I would hope at least that you all went into it with a fresh outlook.
I did. I tried my very best.
For me, it's been something I've been looking at for a very long time. Of course, you're going all the way back to this game's history when I first became aware of it was as part of the Capcom 5.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course. Mm-hmm. So you had Resident Evil 4. Was that in the 5?
Yes.
Yeah. Resident Evil 4, Dead Phoenix.
Yeah, Dead Phoenix, which never came out. Piano 3, Beautiful Joe.
And this.
And I played Beautiful Joe, Resident Evil 4, and they are two of my favorite games on that system. So I was monitoring all of them with some interest, and this as well. And then, of course, you know, it got a good review from Carl. It got a good review from one of the magazines I was reading at the time. So I was interested. But looking into the substance, it's like, I don't think I'm going to enjoy the things that they really like about it. I don't know where that translates to me. So I've always been like, well, if it was cheap or if it was this or if it was that. And this is my first time playing it. I finally got around to it.
And Greg, why don't you go ahead and I know you've played quite a bit of it, certainly more than I did.
Yeah, so I'm up to, Carl, perhaps you could kind of pinpoint, you know, in proportionally where this is in the game, but I'm up to the beginning of, I think it's the fourth, it's called, number four. Or alter ego, where you're in the Dominican Republic. I'm guessing this is the one which culminates with the aforementioned Power Rangers.
The handsome men.
They've just been kind of introduced at the beginning of this chapter.
Yeah, I think they introduced, because you're in the Dominican Republic, because I think that's where the artist is who draws the handsome men.
Right,
That's where they introduced him. Actually, that setting has my favorite music in the game. It's got like some really cool like mandolin stuff. It's really nice.
I very much like the soundtrack, actually. I mean, it's quite eclectic, as you might expect from a game that's this sort of quite literally sort of schizophrenic. But a lot of nice piano stuff is probably my favourite things. It's quite atmospheric, but also quite, you know, at times it goes a bit more whimsical, a bit more fun.
I think my favourite music in the game is actually the music that you get right before when you give the soul shells to the box office guy.
The fucking dance stuff.
I love it. It's like I know that it's super cheesy, but like that music that they play in that little club hallway is, I would literally stay in there like longer to hear more of it.
It's just so annoying, that whole idea of just going through that Colosseum, which makes no physical sense. There's doors that don't go anywhere, and it's just so pointless. I don't really that sums up a lot of this game. game. But I mean, for me, I actually, I should issue a caveat. I had to play the PS2 version of this.
Oh,
basically, because the GameCube version's pretty difficult to get a hold of, seemingly, here at this point. Probably had quite a few opportunities to get it more easily in years past, but at this point, the PS2 version, much more easy. Well, I didn't actually have a PS2, so I had to borrow one from a friend
that
was disused and sort of hook it all up and stuff. But I got there in the end, but of course, something that was kind of typical of these sorts of games is when, you know, you ported to PS2, you know, it's kind of happened with RE4 as well. But at least, you know, from what you read and the load times are kind of worse and all that kind of stuff. So that bears mentioning it as how that affected my experience with it.
Yeah, I think the load times were really the main difference. I think maybe it lost a little bit of visual clarity, but not much. I don't think there were many differences.
And I would say the load times have been slightly annoying for me, even on GameCube.
Yeah, oh yeah,
I did watch some YouTube videos of the GameCube version to try and get a sense of the discrepancy, and I think there is a discernible one, but it is still, and I could imagine it's still an issue. I mean, for me, one of the most important things about games I've talked about in the past is how they flow from moment to moment. You know, I don't necessarily mind a slower paced game. Of course, I'm very amenable to fast paced action games, but the most important thing is that it flows smoothly at whatever pace it is. This game, on the other hand, has a very sort of staccato kind of rhythm to it, because there's all these loading transitions, even, you know, when you go into the room where you will save and like fiddle around with your characters, just like looking at one menu screen essentially of like the save that loads, or if you look at the character screen that loads.
It just seemed very out of place with the kind of, like, it seems like the kind of game where the controls are so stripped down and how you move from room to room is so stripped down that just to have those constant load times, it really kind of breaks up what I thought should be a very like kind of peppy experience.
Right.
The thing is as well, though, I mean, you've got the other sort of element of, well, if the core mechanics of the game is that the enemies that you face, the Heaven Smiles, that will, you know, in some sense go towards you, sometimes fast, slow, whatever, but you know, if they make contact, they blow up and it hurts you, or sometimes it's an instant kill in special cases.
Yeah.
But you can't see them initially.
No.
Right, you'll hear a cackle, and then you'll, I think, press the L button, and that scans.
Yeah, you get tipped off by the audio cue of the laughter, and then you have to sort of scan. So what that does is it kind of bogs things down in itself. It's like, well, I go into a room, okay, I hear the noise, right, scan, all right, nothing yet, let's move forward a bit, scan. And, you know, that in itself might not be that much of a problem, but when you add it to a sort of preponderance of load times, going back to what Johnny said about the exploration kind of elements in it, they can then become very cumbersome feeling as a result, because it's just like, well, I just want to go there and check this thing. You know, this, as Carl said, there's puzzles, you know, a lot of them are not really puzzles. They're just observation tests. And so if you're like, oh, okay, I need to look at that poster over there, that can take a depressing length of time, or not even so much the absolute length of time, but it feels long, because it feels like there's a lot of sand in the wheels of the game as they're kind of churning along. What should be as a brisk task is longer than you'd like. So those were kind of, especially in the early going, that's what I really had to fight through. I think it would have been, you know, if I was just playing this on my own, you know, initiative, I think it would have been much more difficult for me to push through it, because I wouldn't have had the imperative of like, well, we're going to be talking about this in a couple of weeks. Come on, let's do this thing.
I think ultimately what made it not an issue for me is that the levels follow a really distinct pattern, and once you lock into that pattern, it becomes very very much second nature. At least for me, it was.
Yeah, I warmed up to it as time went on, because it's just, initially, it's just so opaque. Everything is so opaque. Yeah. I mean, we expect the story, I do, I mean, even just reading reviews at the time, you would have expected it, but certainly after all these years of discussion, I'm expecting this plot to be impenetrable and whatever, but the presentation of core game concepts is very loose, to say the least. You know, I mean, I remember one of the first times I was in the Harmon's room, where you go, you know, and you put the TV on to look at the characters, but the first screen is the blood, and it just says press X to make serum, and I'm like, why would I do that?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very much a game that makes you sort of discover it. Like, you know, it's not going to put things out in front of you. You're going to have to kind of mess around with it to learn the techniques. Again, when I played it, I was not super encumbered by that kind of stuff. Like, I kind of picked up on it pretty quickly. But I understand why for some people, though, it would be an issue. Like, it is a lot to ask for a gamer to put up with crap just to get to know how to play the game.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does not go out of its way to show you anything. And I kind of just rolled with it. Like, I honestly kind of expected it. Like, I was sort of like, okay, this is going to be weird. It's not trying to be a perfectly designed game. In fact, it kind of enjoys the fact that it doesn't give a shit.
Right.
I just kind of took that
as
part of
the punk attitude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, ultimately for me, what kept me sort of going is, like, once I locked into that pattern and sort of got into the flow of the game, you know, I say in my review, I actually lay out the pattern that all levels follow in this game, except for maybe like the last one. I've got it right here, so I'll read it to you. It's very short. As written by 16-year-old Carl in 2005.
Good thing we sent you a copy of this, because you couldn't have walked into a store and bought it for yourself.
That's what all this was about. This is just Carl trying to prove he was a real man. Oh yeah, I'm big enough for this. I love it.
I'm not scared.
the casual swearing is just, yeah, water off a duck's back.
That's sure. Right.
Well, this is the pattern as told by Carl circa 2006 or 2005 actually. Fight through heaven smile until you find some posters on the wall or advice given to you by the supporting cast, i.e. Iwazaru, your bondage clad assistant, or Travis, the ghost of the first man you killed. Use this information when it's asked of you, sometimes by a dismembered head. Collect the odd engraving, and I put in parentheses here, I don't care what you call it, that's a damn key and you know it. Then you use the odd engraving to gain access to a new area or to secure a ring as given to you by the head. And then you use this ring to solve the final puzzle, and after you've collected the various soul shells, you enter the boss fight, sometimes also taking on a new type of heaven smile on the way there. That's basically the pattern that every level follows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is eventually, once you kind of find your feet with it, you know, there is a predictable formula amidst the sort of wackiness of many of the game's trappings that you can kind of latch onto. Yeah, you probably end up doing less pointless backtracking because you can intuit more what you should be doing first or whatever because of that predictable format.
Yeah, I think honestly the biggest problem with Killer 7 is that it does become a little too easy to discern.
Whoa, get off that horse for a second.
No. I'm serious. I mean, once you get kind of a little bit further in the game, things become very, very clear. And I'm not talking about the story, I'm talking about the gameplay. I'm talking about like what you're supposed to do in the game to progress forward. It becomes sort of like, okay, do this, do this, do this.
Perfunctory.
Mm-hmm. Now the dressing there, I feel, makes it exciting enough to keep going forward, but it is a problem in the game. Then that, and I bring that up in here in my review.
Yeah, because even in Suda's next game, No More Heroes, there's definitely a pattern to that game as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But each individual mission tends to take a kind of an odd, there's always a twist, and it's a different twist every mission. But there's always something kind of weird. I mean, there's one level in No More Heroes where you just go through a sewer tunnel.
Yeah.
Straight. It's probably a tribute to Killer 7, of which there are many, I now realize. But there's not really any exploration. There's not really much combat in there. It's just you walk down this very long tunnel, and then you get to the boss at the end, and he's automatically killed by another character, and you don't actually even have to fight him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a game that's always kind of – it sets you up for certain expectations of how it's going to go down, and then it thwarts those. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy that aspect of No More Heroes, among many other things. I like that game. I gave it a good review. But Killer 7, I'm not far enough into it to know whether it sticks to that pattern all the way through, but it sounds like it does. But I mean, even like by the second mission, I could see the pattern.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the ongoing pattern in really all Grasshopper manufactured games, from, you know, Killer 7 all the way down to even Shadows of the Damned, is that in between the boss battles, it's very, very samey.
Yeah, and I actually found it to be very tiresome in No More Heroes 2.
So did I. I found it a lot more frustrating in No More Heroes than I found it in Killer 7. Maybe because I prefer Killer 7 to No More Heroes just because I feel like the story and the characters are a lot more interesting. But yeah, I mean, with Killer 7, I feel like it really shines in those just ridiculous boss fights. Like the one where you're, I mean, I don't, I'm, Greg, I think you probably got into this point already, where It's when you're fighting against Ayame Blackburn, and she's just racing on the track, and you have to hit her at, like, light speed.
Yeah, she says, this is a character that's wearing, like, a giant mask to make her look like an anime character, and actually has, like, an anime intro where she speaks in Japanese, or, you know. She's not all that deadly, so you could kind of just play the long game and pick your shots. But the thing is, for me, there's a lot of pressure on these boss fights to deliver big time. I mean, similar in No More Heroes. I mean, No More Heroes, you could argue you've basically got two kinds of padding. You've got the bits where you're milling around to Santa Destroy, and then you've got the bits where you're just doing the kind of brawler stuff.
Right.
And then the bosses is kind of where it's really at.
The reward. Yeah.
And on balance, apart from that particular mission that Johnny mentioned where they screw you out of a boss altogether, I thought the bosses kind of did well enough in carrying the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, Killer 7 so far, I'm more iffy. What I like about them is that they actually have a slightly more substantial puzzle element than the rest of the game. The rest of the game has these, you're really kind of almost caricatures of Resident Evil puzzles from the early days of the series, you know, with those Carl mentioned with the engravings and all that kind of stuff. So I like, you know, there's one relatively early on where you shoot the guy's tie so that then the other guy will go to straighten it and thus expose his weak point in his brain, which is hanging out the back of his skull. You know, so it's things you actually have to figure out that are kind of more substantial. I like that part of it, but still, as a kind of, isn't really an action game, but, you know, on an action point of view, it's still a bit thin for me to kind of sustain all the rest of it.
Mm. Yeah, but the really surprising thing to me playing Killer 7 now, and I've played it, this is really my third time playing it. The first time was at E3 back in 2004, 2005. I played the demo, and I was really excited to play Killer 7 because I love the art style, and that's all I'd seen of it. But when they first showed it, I thought this was one of the coolest looking games I'd ever seen. It's like a really mature sort of spin on the Wind Waker toon shading almost. So I was very excited about that. And then when I played it at E3 and I hated it, I hated that demo.
Yeah.
Almost immediately I thought, what are they doing? Why does this game play this way?
They are doing meh.
It looks so cool and it plays so badly.
Yeah, I think you and Mike played it at E3 this year. I think both of you really disliked it.
Yeah, and it was a big disappointment for me. It was probably my biggest disappointment that year. And then I didn't play it when it came out because, you know, it was such a bad demo for me. And so then years later, it was either you or Andy Gergen, I think, who sent me a copy of it to borrow and mailed it. And I played it for maybe an hour and a half and did not get very far. Like, now that I've gotten farther, I know that I did not get very far at all. I don't even think I got the water ring. Or the fire ring, which you can do in probably 15 minutes if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I had no idea what I was doing because, I mean, this already came up, but the game is so opaque at the beginning. It doesn't explain any, and I did not understand the most basic elements of how to play this game.
Here's a good example, though. I had kind of forgotten how the game starts going because I've beaten it twice, but it's been a long fucking time. So when I start the game, and you get to the room at the very first level with the candles. The game doesn't tell you, hey, you need something to light this. It says insufficient fire.
Yeah.
That is how the game tells you can't do something right here. Do I have some fire and I need more? You're implying there's already fire. Is my fire just not of the right quality to light these candles? What do you want from me?
Yeah, at that point I was like, who fucking cares? It's a fucking Suda 51 game. I was just like, whatever. Like, I didn't really take anything that I came across that seriously.
Yeah.
This probably isn't complicated at all. In fact, it's probably pretty dumb.
It never is, no.
Yeah. Or the toilet has no water in the same scene.
Yep.
Yeah. I just flushed it. Of course it doesn't have any water, jackass. But no, it's not telling you it flushed. It's telling you it can't.
Yeah, there isn't anything in there that's so opaque. It's like, okay, I need water in there. Let's look around. Is there anything in this room? Because there's only like two objects that you can interact with in any room, right? Like,
what I found difficult, and I guess I don't know how I got through this before, is the lack of any kind of map system. Because depending on what angle you're coming through, the room can look totally different.
There is a map.
There is a map, though.
There is?
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Where's that?
It's not very useful, though, because it doesn't actually show your current position.
Yeah, it's just a layout of the area, basically.
It lights up where you are, does it not?
It lights up the general area that you're in, yeah, but it doesn't show where you are or what direction you're heading, and it's very difficult to make heads or tails of it.
Just something like in the screen while you're moving, so you can say, "Oh, I'm there. I've already been here."
You've got the compass. Oh, so, oh yeah, that's a big help.
Okay, it's like a key geographical idea of where I'm at.
I've been heading north for a few screens.
Yeah,
I keep going on Meet Santa. Yeah. What I actually found more frustrating, just starting the game over again, you know, without a big recollection of how that level played, was. The game tells you, you're going to need to use the thief to open this lock. You already have all seven characters unlocked. You know how you figure out who the thief is? Well, I can eliminate her because she's female, and I can eliminate the guy I just used. So it's one of these other five.
Should have read the game manual.
Good old manuals.
So in the end, it was like the third person I tried. I'm like, if I had to go through all five remaining characters, I'd have been really fucking pissed at this game.
Yeah. It's a coyote, right? That's a thief, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can learn that from a carrier pigeon in the second mission or something.
But this is in the first mission!
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just like the game reveals very fundamental aspects of what's going on very slowly. I think eventually it does tell you pretty much everything you need to know, but it tells you some of these things long after you would have needed to know them.
I don't think they ever actually say in the game that Kevin can turn invisible.
Yeah, they do. It's one of the carrier pigeon reports.
Yeah, it does. They kind of, like, if you're talking to Iwazaru or whatever, it's kind of implied in that. But in the carrier pigeon thing, it's explicitly said. But, you know, I mean, you could miss those or not pay attention. Or,
yeah, because there's no indicator that there's a carrier pigeon coming up until you already, usually it's off on some little side area.
Mm-hmm. And you're actually there and it just says carrier pigeon. Like, that is that's the option at the junction.
Yeah, it's a game that there's not really any way for them to hide things. Right. Yeah, there aren't really any hidden objects, aren't really any nooks and crannies that you might not find otherwise, because the exploration, such as it is so blunt that they can't really hide things from you. You just have to make sure that you try all the paths.
Yeah, it almost has like a kind of a board game element to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a very astute point. Like it plays out a lot like a board game. You know, you sort of work your way to a path. And then you might get a dead end, but you just reroute to the next path in that place. And eventually you'll hit everything. Like, you know, it's a game where by ultimately persistence, you will win.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, we've definitely compared this to like one of the early Resident Evil games. And I certainly thought of that playing it. And by the way, those games I really don't like very much at all.
Those games are terrible. They're horrible.
Yeah. I mean, the difference there is their stories are not any good. So no.
They're amazingly bad.
Here's the thing. I understand where people say, like, oh, it's sort of like the early Resident Evil games and that there are fixed camera angles and such. But, I mean, look, those games are unplayable due to the controls. In the Killer 7, I understand there are control issues, but they are far superior to those Resident Evil games.
You're right. The controls are better, but the gameplay is strikingly similar. You have these lumbering enemies coming towards you, and you have, it's difficult sometimes to see all of them at the same time. Sometimes they get cheap hits on you because there's just too many of them. It's hard to
hit.
You can't really aim as quickly as you'd like. You can't move and shoot at the same time. You have these abstract ass ridiculous puzzles. You have characters speaking to you with things that make no sense at all. It is similar to Resident Evil. I mean, there's no denying that.
Yeah, it's big similarities, and I'm not a fan of those early Resident Evil games either. But in this sense, the stripped down movement it actually helps.
Yes.
The fact that you can just do a quick turn is like a huge thing in a old school Resident Evil game.
Yeah, they added that in RE3 finally, I think.
Yeah, so in that sense, I actually found that, you know, if you're going to make a game of that style, this does improve it to some extent. You know, the fact that you can actually effectively backpedal on certain enemies. And in some cases, it's a very valid strategy. Like when you get the giant smiles, start toppling, and you can just run backwards, and then they'll topple and they won't hit you. You know, so that's something that, rather than like the ridiculous turning, it's all Resident Evil. You know, going backwards was not really an option, as I recall, from playing Resident Evil 2. And also, this might have been one of the good things about playing it on PS2, is I kind of had the movement just on the PS2 D-pad. So that just felt more intuitive, I think, than the whole A and B, is it, on the GameCube?
Yeah, A to move forward, B to turn around.
I mean, it's really kind of cosmetic kind of difference, but you're up on the D-pad to go forward and then tap down to do the quick turn. Actually, you know, I got my head around that relatively quick, because I know for some people, we read the reviews at the time, and some people just like the very concept of holding down A to go forward was just heretical for game design.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like an older PC game flavor, like 80s PC game kind of thing, where they actually had restrictions to work within. So, you know, they could probably get away with something like that.
Four bits of power.
Exactly. Like, you could only go left or right, like one of the old King's Quest games kind of thing, where, you know...
It's Clock Tower is what you're describing.
Just because they had to make it that way.
Yeah. The other game that I really thought of a lot playing this, and maybe this is more based on personal experiences, so I don't know if any of you guys would have come across this, but it reminded me of my experience trying to play the first Metal Gear Solid. And I've told this story before, how I attempted it multiple times. I couldn't get into it. I didn't understand how to play the game, which is not to say I didn't understand the controls. I didn't understand what you're supposed to do, how to do it. You know, I understood how to control a character. I didn't understand how to actually get through here. I couldn't find the pattern. I didn't know how to be successful at it. And I ended up, the only way I ever got into Metal Gear Solid as a series is I borrowed it from a friend. I borrowed Twin Snakes after I tried multiple times to play the original PS1 version. And I took a game guide and I basically sat down and played the guide all the way through. And doing so taught me enough about how the series works that I could go on and play 2, 3, and 4 without a guide.
Without training wheels, son.
Yeah, well, I'm not ashamed to do that. I've tried multiple times to play Killer 7 and could not get into it, did not understand the most basic things about how this game works. And so I took this game guide from GameSpot back in 2005 and said, okay, I'm just going to use this to go through the level. And it helped. It helped a lot. I learned things about how to heal my characters. I learned about where I should be putting
The healing. We didn't even mention that.
I learned that there's a difference between thick blood and thin blood, which
this is true.
Is not explained whatsoever by the game.
They didn't even tell you what thick and thin blood are.
I obviously knew that you could upgrade your characters, but I didn't have any kind of direction as to what was a good strategy for doing that. So the game guide helped me build up one of my characters in a way that actually makes the game a little bit easier to play, which was valuable for me.
Yeah.
I didn't understand really how the puzzles worked. I didn't understand what they were going for with the puzzles. And once you get through a few of those, you do understand a lot more about what's going on. And I've gone through a couple missions now. I could probably put down the guide and play through the rest of the game. It would take me longer and be more frustrating, which is why I'm not going to do that. I'm going to keep using the guide. But I've learned enough now that I do understand the basics and I get what's going on, and I could now play it without that. And that was a really big difference for me. And in doing that, I got into the game enough. The thing is, like, a lot of what's going on here, you're not going to appreciate at all until you've played it an entire level. And the missions are not short. Really surprised at how long they are. I mean, I think Carl's defense of, well, the bosses are really cool, is pretty thin considering the bosses are a very tiny portion of the game. Because there's a lot of level before you get to the boss. So if you don't like the level, you can't really lean that much on, well, though the boss was really cool when I got to the
end. And also, they're not, again, not surprisingly, you see this carry through to No More Heroes to some extent. You know, in some cases, they're more there for the joke value than they are for the gameplay value. Like the bit where you have the female assassin with the glasses, and it's just a shootout. Like, you just shoot at each other, and whoever shot the other one the most times wins. I mean, it's a good gag. But it's a shitty boss fight.
Really? That's the thing. I really love those stylistic choices where they make it's like, look, it's not even about like winning or losing. It's just really getting into the feel of the game. Like, I also really love the Curtis Blackburn boss fight.
Well, that makes more sense. That's pretty much the last thing I did.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, that makes more sense to me. You got this sort of the draw aspect, you know, who's drawing, but like that worked. The other one was just kind of like the equivalent of button mashing.
Sure.
I mean, there's a bit more sort of finesse to the Blackburn. Well, I mean, it's much later in the game, so you might expect that would be the case.
Yeah, I mean, he basically pulls off a John Woo movie in that boss fight. It's awesome. It's really, really cool. And I think that's what holds the appeal for this game for me. Now, I suppose it'll depend on whether or not this is a game that you enjoy or that you don't enjoy. It depends on whether, A, you sort of lock into the rhythm, and then B, whether or not you find the atmosphere, the story, etc., compelling enough to make up for the sameness in the gameplay.
I mean, with the story stuff, it's kind of weird trying to pin down, you know, at first what kind of narrative it's going to be. Mm. I mean, for me, it sort of took us never really looking into it. You know, you just know it's weird, and it's obviously influenced by very many kind of Western movies, but not really knowing which ones in particular. It took quite an unexpected turn for me early on when you have the whole thing about, in this world, there was a big treaty that guaranteed world peace, but they stopped air travel and built giant intercontinental railways and, the nuclear disarmament in the form of quote-unquote fireworks. It's just like, this is like one of those really massive, convoluted kind of anime.
And very, very Kojima-like, actually. The political intrigue aspect of it and the weird out-of-nowhere anime cutscene. I was not expecting that at all.
Yeah.
I guess it explains a bit about why the game's on two discs on GameCube. But I didn't see that coming at all.
The art style in those cutscenes it changes from mission to mission.
Yeah.
Like they'll switch it up on you. There's actually one, the Andre Almeida level, which might be my favorite, is done, actually it's all done in flash animation. And it's really cool, the stylistic choices that they make in that one. And like, it's literally like you're walking around, the entire city is like just white on like off white. And it's such a weird atmosphere that it casts. I find it really fascinating. Now,
that whole level is a very big sort of change of pace because you're in open environments. We're still obviously just going on a rail. You know, that hasn't changed. Obviously something that fundamental can't change, but it does affect the gameplay because now all of a sudden you'll have some of those smiles that are just sort of jogging along innocently, and they'll be jogging, you know, and they'll never hit you.
No.
You know, if you don't run into them. Mm-hmm. And so it actually affords you the opportunity to shoot. They're really easy to shoot because they've got these big yellow shirts on. So that's their whole kind of critical area. And that is, you know, something we haven't really talked about yet. The real spine of the shooting gameplay is that the enemies have these weak spots where you can get a critical hit and kill them instantly and get more rewards for that. And these guys are easily picked off. Out in the open, you can start racking up the multipliers or whatever, you know, getting all this blood that we talked about, to level up your characters and heal yourself. Or the game just becomes radically easier all of a sudden, just because it's out in the open.
At the end of the game, once you're in the last like couple stages, you've upgraded your character so much that literally they don't even have weak spots anymore. If you hit them, they will die.
I mean, that's the thing. I guess it's, I can imagine, especially from the beginning of the game, you know, I've already felt it to a significant extent where I am. There is a sense of empowerment that happens because, you know, I was finding it very difficult just to kill a few enemies, do basic sort of exploration, getting around the levels. Mm-hmm. Whereas once you get further on, your characters are powered up and stuff. There is greater ease to the game. So it is, you know, a bit like 8-bit Metroid or something in that way, that, you know, there's a kind of, it's really steep hill to climb at the start. So I think that may be a big problem for a lot of people if they've been trying this for the first time, you know, maybe playing along with us or whatever, is just getting over the hump.
Yeah, and I found that I was getting over the hump really pretty quickly, actually. And that's one thing I wanted to convey to Carl here is that
I think the guide helps in that regard.
Yeah, it does.
Obviously,
big time.
Yes. Yeah, and it helped me to build up a one character in a very efficient way, so that by the end of the first mission, I had a pretty stacked character.
Yeah, I think you said you were leveling up Kaede, right?
Right. Yeah.
She's the sharpshooter of the group, so yeah, having her.
Yeah. But she's also good as just a general shooter, and I had her powered up a lot by the end of the first level, and so I'm using her pretty much all the time, and eventually I'll upgrade the other characters and use them more, but just to start out, it's nice to have one character who's actually pretty good, you know, so it's worth focusing on one character at the beginning, I think.
Yeah, I stuck with Dan, and then I went to Mask Smith.
Yeah, Mask Smith is cool.
Yeah, he's good.
He comes into play a lot in, I think, the second level. or the second stage.
Yeah, and then there's, you get the powered up version of him, like in the fourth level, with the crotchless pants. Could have done without that. Good lord.
Yeah, yeah. When he changes costumes a couple times.
And he sort of puts the flag in the ground for the game's sort of sensibilities, where he headbutts a bullet that's been shot at him.
Yes.
That kind of lets you know where we stand with the narrative of this.
The one thing that I'm disappointed, and James will know what I'm talking about, because he's the only one other than me here who's finished it, but it does bum me up that you guys didn't finish the whole thing, and I realize that, you know, logistically it's a little bit difficult, or not logistically, but just practically it's a little bit difficult to finish a 20-hour game.
It's like a 20-hour game.
It's like a 20-hour game, yeah.
Jeez, that's a lot longer than I would have expected.
There is a point in this game where you go like, damn, it's still going?
Always a great reaction playing a video game.
Well, I'm just bummed that you guys did not get to the elementary school.
Jesus.
Because...
sounds wholesome.
It's when revelations are made, and they are spectacularly crazy. I'd sort of like to say them, but I wouldn't want to spoil you guys. And I mean, I don't know how sensitive you guys are to stuff like that.
Yeah, I'd go for it.
One of the big revelations of the game is that from the inception of the United States, post American Revolution, from the beginning, the United States has the elections of the United States. All the political movements have been orchestrated by the Japanese.
Yes.
Okay.
And that because this is the first elementary school in the country, which, by the way, it's in Washington State.
First elementary school ever.
Yeah.
Elementary school prime.
Because everyone, of course, in the United States, I get the feeling that when Suda sort of did his research, he was like...
Research? His research was called Wrath of Bong.
Yeah, no, when he did his research, he just sort of looked at Wikipedia articles or just a very basic outline of the way politics work in America. He's like, yeah, I'll use this. Yeah. So, like, basically...
I think you give him way too much credit.
They have something called elections.
Yeah, so basically, the Japanese government controls this elementary school, and its principal is like a big head honcho in the organization. And so, because he's the principal, since everyone in America votes at elementary schools, if you are the principal of said elementary school, you decide who wins the election.
Oh, God.
Wow.
It is awesome.
It's audacious.
It is a complete disregard for the intelligence of the people playing the game at this point. It's just like, look.
But here's the thing. There's one thing, and I think I'm sort of curious if you agree with me here, James. There's one really poignant part in that level though, where the boss at the last stage of that elementary school, it's an unwinnable boss fight. You're going to lose. And so really these characters who you've all sort of gotten to know, you see them die one by one, because of course you cycle through these characters, you'll play one of the seven personalities over and over again. And so you see every single one trying their special ability on these enemies, saying, will this work, will this work, will this work, and none of them work, and you see each one of them die. And I felt like that was a really poignant part of the game.
I'm not sure I felt it was poignant. I felt like, yep, the game has decided, welcome, I'm going to make you powerless.
I was affected by that. Like, that was like, that's really kind of fucked up. So, because you sort of see that you get a sense of helplessness, and it really moves you towards the story. And I feel like that's a really powerful thing. I was really surprised by the sophistication of that.
I didn't think of it as sophisticated. I thought it was more like, this is how this game had to end.
Mm. Well, I mean, ultimately, it's not how it ends, though. I mean, there's a whole other thing where you go to the... Well,
this is the direction it had to go, I guess, is the better way of putting it.
Sure. Okay, I understand, yeah. But I would still really, really recommend that you finish it through. I think that there are really notable moments of brilliance in this game that I feel like you don't get in other games.
You're only 17 hours away, Johnny. I mean, at this point.
Well, I do want to keep playing. I mean, I always say this about Retroactive. I want to keep playing. It's hard for me to find the time because I've got other things that I'm more interested in playing. But I would like to – I want to see these crazy anime cutscenes in between the levels. I want to see some of these bosses that you think are really creative and interesting. I want to see different environments rendered in this amazing art style and graphics engine that they put together. So there are reasons for me to want to keep going.
To me, having the perspective of having gone through this ordeal multiple times now, like, those are the parts of the game that I wanted more of, and everything else I wanted drastically less of.
What, you know, obviously, yeah, those boss fights are few and far between. Those anime cutscenes are also kind of few and far between. What, you know, there has to be something there to keep you going in the meantime. And what kept me going are I love the vignettes with Suicide Head and Travis and Iwazuru. I think they're hysterical. Like, there's such a sick gallows humor to them. I think it's hysterical.
Yeah, I think Iwarazu is not very interesting. After the first time that you meet him, I think he becomes tiresome very quickly. And
I do wish they talked faster. Would be nice.
Yeah, yeah. The pacing issue again. Wise with the flow of the game, a lot of it bogs it down. And the thing is, in the first level or so, like Iwazaru's everywhere. Like,
yeah, he is in it too much. Yeah,
ostensibly teaching you how to play the game, but as I think we've already suggested, not doing it very effectively. But later on, that's obviously not such a problem. But then still, some of those sequences go on a bit too long, with like the decapitated head is telling you about how she jumped off a building and landed on a mother or what, you know. I get the black comedy of it, but played as it is through the gibberish and the slow text scroll, it just seems to linger a bit longer than I would like.
I feel like it could have retained the style, but it could have been done much more efficiently.
Let me advance through the text.
Yeah.
I mean, what's weird though is the gibberish is actually the words he's saying, but they're not written the same.
Like, yeah.
Well, I think it's more about, you know, it's not just like a kind of Star Fox thing. I mean, some of it is the implication that obviously the distinction between the characters that are sort of dead, like all the bosses that you kill, pop back up at some point, and you talk to them, and also anybody who talks in gibberish is like some ghost, essentially. So I think the distinction is there for that purpose rather than because they didn't want to have so much voice acting.
Well, no, but what's weird though is that the gibberish a lot of times half matches the text that's being displayed.
Right. It's been run through some kind of filter or...
But what's weird though is that many times they'll be saying the same thing with just different words.
Oh, where it's not a direct like copy over from the text. Yeah.
It's like somebody had a script of what they were going to say and then said, all right, now change all the words.
Yeah, I thought a little bit of the Twin Peaks thing where David Lynch had people say their lines backwards and then he played them in reverse so that it sounds forward, but it sounds really weird.
Mm.
So they're speaking English in the correct direction, but only because it's been manipulated, and it sounds like it's been manipulated, and it just is really offsetting. But it's vaguely understandable. And I mean, it's not the same technique being used here, but it gives off pretty much the same vibe.
Yeah, I think, and it's a similar distinction as well, as I said, in terms of these like ghost people,
right.
You know, to kind of imply what there's something wrong with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I am certainly not opposed to weird games. In fact, I like weird games. I like
Cubivore.
That aspect of it. Yes, I'm on the box for Cubivore. So I
he's
like...
He's actually pictured on the box being eaten.
But,
he actually is Cubivore.
So I like that part of it. Playing the game is not as bad as I thought it was now that I actually understand what I'm doing.
Put that on the box.
I don't think it's a really fun game to play, but it's not torturous to play, which is better than I was expecting. And, you know, I think the story is potentially enough to keep me interested over time. So let's get to some of the forum posts. We've covered a lot of the topics that are brought up in here, but I did want to spread the word on and share some of the comments that people made. A lot of people were kind of like us playing it for the first time. There were a couple people who'd played it before, and I do want to call out, I didn't really pull anything from this, but a poster named Lithium posted some incredibly thorough and very, very prolonged posts, basically analysis of the story and of what's going on, relating it to, I mean, it's referenced. It has actual citations in it. And this is especially for you, Carl, but anyone else listening who's really, really into the story of Killer 7 and would like an almost academic-style breakdown of what's going on in this game, you should definitely read those. I found them to be pretty impenetrable, but a lot of them are about things that I haven't seen in the game yet.
Yeah, there's a whole background of the game relating to Japanese and Chinese mythology that you might not get on the first playthrough.
I wouldn't get it on the 100th playthrough, but I'm glad that some people do. So there's that stuff. And if you're a huge fan of Killer 7 and you haven't been by the forum thread yet, it is absolutely worth going to check that stuff out. I'm sure you'll find it very interesting. But we had stuff like Black Hole Ninja posted. I bought Killer 7 because I really enjoyed the No More Heroes franchise. It seems the common thread of all Suda51's games is a focus on style to the point the gameplay suffers. Anyway, my first impression of the game is that it's old-school adventure game masked behind layers of insanity. I like the overall overall style of the game, but the shooting mechanic could use some work.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a few things about this. I mean, certainly we've sort of established some of the similarities with adventure games. It would be more effective as an adventure game if the puzzles were more creative, mm-hmm. more substantial, really. I mean, I think that's one of my big complaints is that, you know, if you could actually have that part of it be a satisfying adventure game kind of on its own merits, that would be far better to go in between the boss fights as set pieces than, you know, some of what you actually get, which is very perfunctory puzzles and a lot of shooting. Now, but then on the shooting issue, I think it's important to note that what we have here is one of those weird issues where it's like, if you have a game where you level up somebody's ability to shoot, it implies that it's kind of crap to start with.
Right.
And that's what you have here. I mean, you know, every character has a waiver stat, which basically means how much the gun sight floats by itself without you moving it. And you have to level that up. In some cases, like with the sharpshooter, Katie Smith or whatever, her wavering is awful to start with. Yeah. And of course, when she zooms in, it's even worse because she's just all over the place. So it's like very imperative you level that up straight away. But on the other hand, someone like Kevin Smith, the weird guy with the white hair, he's pretty much rock steady from the outset. I mean, you could still level that stat up, but you know, that's the kind of trade-off you have with some of these characters. Some are very weak, but they're very reliable, and then others obviously are very powerful but kind of wild in their aims and stuff. And so again, when it's not really presented to you immediately, they're like, okay, these guys are underpowered right now, you know, and what you need to do is build them up. I think some people kind of think, oh god, the aiming's terrible straight away, because they're not really appreciating the fact, well, it's part of the game's progression that it gets better.
But see, I would say that the method through which aiming is done is beyond that particular stat, is hampered because it's always kind of crud to have to control a cursor on screen with the GameCube analog controller.
Right. Yeah, actually, we have another forum post along the same lines. So Soren posted, "The shooting mechanic is so clumsy, it somewhat ruins the joy you would have in killing all of the Heaven Smile. Hitting their weak spot is a thrill, that's a critical, but the aiming is so spotty, it's frustrating." And I agree with Greg that it is sort of by design bad at the beginning, and it gets better as you go. But if you find the game kind of intolerable to play right from the get-go, you may not ever get to the point where it gets better. And that is definitely an issue. It was an issue for me the last time I tried to play this game.
Or even just like trying different characters. As I say, if you try the full spectrum of characters, I think that will kind of make it clear to you, all right, well, some of these guys start off with a better aim.
Yeah, but you know, some of them are locked away at the beginning, so you can't try them all at first.
Exactly. That's what I mean. To me, it really fails to introduce the concepts adequately to kind of prevent some of these things. I mean, you could take a leaf out of the Metroid book, or so they have them begin the game like an introductory level with actually really great aim, and then something happens to them that they lose it, and then you realize, oh, okay, well, now I've got to level them back up to that point, rather than just kind of, you know, it is throwing people in at the deep end. They've just got the game and you can't even fucking aim straight. I mean, you know, it is pretty counterintuitive in that way. So the combination of the unorthodox movement and then this, you know, deliberately kind of wayward aiming, a lot of people just say, oh, controls are terrible, and you know, they throw their hands up and that's that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really helps if you just approach the game with the idea that you're going to experiment with it. Like, I mean, I went in and I said, okay, well, I really don't know what any of these characters mean. Apparently I've gotten some unlocked, but I'm just going to mess around and just...
I mean, that's another thing. I mean, the whole thing of like, well, you have to kill so many enemies to wake certain ones up that are dormant. That's not explained at all. I didn't really understand why I could unlock certain ones after a while until probably a few levels in. I mean, it's another example.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually brought up Twin Peaks earlier, but Mr. Lakitu posted, "Whereas most David Lynch movies are more of an art to admire than your typical popcorn flicks, I think Killer 7 is itself best watched while someone else has the awful time playing it." I just wish I hadn't been that someone else each time. It's not a bad game, just a frustrating experience from start to finish. I feel like if it was released as a summer of arcade title on XBLA today, it would be lapped up. And what I like about this post is it's not that I think that this game shouldn't have been on a disc or something, or that it was ahead of its time or something, but I do think Killer 7 would be is a really good candidate for a remake. If you gave it to another, a different company, like Suda's done, Suda's mark is on this game forever, okay?
Yeah,
he does not need to get involved
it.
With it again. But I say give it to a completely different developer and let them go through and clean it up a little bit.
Oh, man.
And I think this game would be a lot more playable and a lot more accessible for people without losing any of the crazy charm that it has.
What I would love is if they gave this, if Level 5 actually remade it with
they
like...
They wouldn't touch this game with a 5,000 foot pole.
I know they would never do it, but if we're talking hypotheticals here, look, Killer 7 is never going to get remade, so the entire conversation is bullshit.
Yeah, you're right. It's not.
But if, you know, if we're talking Dreamland wishes here, you know, Kirby's Return to Dreamland wishes, then I would love to have Level 5 remake, because I think they could bring sort of their Professor Layton know-how and give it some really interesting, cool puzzles. I feel like that's sort of the big tragedy of the game, is that the puzzles are just shit.
They are really bad.
Well, and also, I think if you were talking about it as a digital game, you wouldn't have the need to pad it, you know, to 20 hours or this kind of stuff. You know, it's as long as it is, and that's good enough for 1,200 Microsoft points or whatever it would be. You know, that I think that would be a kind of nice setting for this kind of game. You know, that's the problem, I guess, you know, that in this point in history when it's coming out, you had this real kind of awkwardness of like, well, everything's got to be this many hours. You see it manifest itself in many ways. Even the best games, you know, some like Metroid Prime or Wind Waker, you've got these bits at the end where they're just tacking on running time.
Yep.
Yeah, I feel like Killer 7 would be a game that would hold up really well to episodic releases. You know, release like one of these chapters at a time.
Yeah. So maybe Telltale could do it.
Yeah, maybe, you never know. I would love to see a return to the Killer 7 universe. There are sly hints to them. In, you know, the No More Heroes games especially, and slight ones in Shadows of the Damned. But, you know, I don't think Suda's going to go back to this. It didn't sell particularly well.
It definitely put him on the map, though. Whatever
it,
else
it,
you
yeah,
say.
Yeah, well,
you
here's know, the thing. It was his first major release in the States. Because Michigan didn't release here. It released in Japan and Europe. And Flower Sun and Rain sure as fuck didn't release here.
Well, it came out... Flower Sun and Rain came out much later as a DS game.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, but it didn't really... Like, originally, it wasn't...
No, the PS2 version didn't come out, but the DS version did, and the damage is still done.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess the ultimate tragedy is that I felt like I've liked Grasshopper games less and less since Killer 7. You know, I liked No More Heroes a lot, and I like No More Heroes 2, but a little bit less so. And Shadows of the Damned, I feel like that style on that, like, sort of irreverence for design is sort of leaving.
It's going too mainstream, he's gone too commercial, you know, he's sold out.
He's selling the fuck out, yeah.
Yeah, it's not about the music anymore.
For me, I think the biggest difference that I kind of detect, even from my limited exposure from this to some of the latter Suda games, is that just that this is trying to be more disturbing. Mm. You know, I mean, it's definitely trying to be funny, you know, and the casual swearing, and it's, you know, it's crass and all this kind of stuff. But there is, you know, with all the dead characters and the, you know, the subject matter, and, you know, sometimes I think the problem is that the focus gets too broad. You know, when you've got all these kind of convoluted political, you know, kind of macro narrative, if you like, kind of going on in the background, it kind of detracts from it. But, you know, on the more personal level, it's trying to be kind of unsettling in amongst the sort of black comedy of it, which is not something that's in No More Heroes.
No. You know,
it's just crass. It's just funny.
Yeah, this is more of a horror game. For certain, and I still find that the like the laugh that cues you that there's an enemy nearby, it's a very jarring sound effect, and it's not funny. It's not that it bothers me, but I don't like it. It's unsettling, you know, like it's just kind of an unpleasant sound.
Yeah, when you first start the game, like I don't think there's even much music at the beginning, so all you hear are your own footsteps, and then you just hear the cackle. And, you know, that's like, it's very unsettling. I think there are a lot of parts in the game where you sort of, it can sort of almost make you not want to play it, in that it's super creepy, and it just sort of makes you feel like, oh.
And I mean, you've still got some of that, as I said, in the gameplay where, it's better, as we said, the traditional Resident Evil in terms of you can turn and all that, but because you're limited, because you don't even necessarily know where the enemies are coming from and stuff, there is a sense of being a bit sort of vulnerable in those kinds of scenes and all that. So I think that's got to be the real difference, you know, between this and this, because you know, something like No More Heroes, I mean, it's basically just a big, merry, pop culture reveling jaunt, you know, through the whole thing. This has got a little bit of something extra to it, which, you know, in a way... kind of drew me in a little more. But on the other hand, I think the problem that I would have, that I've had, and I think building to the climax that Carl talked about, is I just don't know whether I'm invested enough in these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know how unlikable any of them are. Some of them are kind of more badass than others, maybe, or whatever. But it's kind of because they can't really speak to each other, and they don't really have any proper kind of dialogue scenes, because you might be any one of them at any point.
Right.
It's difficult to actually build those characters up in a narrative sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very fair point, actually.
Well, to sort of put a capper on the conversation, people have asked me a few times, like, seriously, like, why do you like Killer 7? Like, what's the fucking deal? And honestly, to tell you the complete truth, when I played it, I played it over the summer, and I dedicated like a week to playing it, and it there's nothing quite like Killer 7 on the GameCube.
Or on anything.
Yeah.
It's in a style all to its own. It's a really, really fresh, whether you like it or you don't, it's different. And just the what I was looking for in a game at that time, and the really fantastic time that I had playing it, really getting into the story, sort of locking into the rhythm of the game. So it just hit me at the exact right way. And so, when I review a video game, I review the experience that I had, because ultimately that shit's all subjective anyway. You can't really put real numbers on anything. There's nothing objective about it. So, well, I review the experience that I had playing that game. And the experience that I had played in that game was amazing. And I don't say that lightly. It was a truly amazing experience that I really do cherish. It's one of the best games that I played on the GameCube, bar none.
Have you gone back and played it again?
Yeah, I played it about a year ago, most recently. And, there are a little still those kind of growing pains in the beginning where you're just like, ugh, this feels sloppy. But once you lock into that rhythm again, I feel like it comes right back to you.
I mean, from a purely experience standpoint of what you see and what you feel playing the game, I rate the game very highly. It's just, and if I could just watch this game, like one of the posts alluded to, I think I would have actually enjoyed it more. From the actual mechanics of gameplay is where the game starts to break for me, and it's kind of disappointing. And No More Heroes has the same problem. I really struggled to finish No More Heroes because it was just like, guys, are you paying attention to what you're doing to this game? Like, you're actively trying to diminish the fun of it. Maybe Goichi Suda should just make games of boss rushes.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that.
That's pretty much what No More Heroes 2 is.
He could just make a boss rush and then a 30-minute video, and then another boss rush, and then another 30. He could just go ahead and just take out the levels from Metal Gear Solid games and make those. Which is terrifying because he's been working with
Kojima.
Kojima, yeah.
On Project S,
I think that's a really... I don't know if it's going to be a constructive pairing, but it's a very, creatively, it's an excellent pairing. I don't know that those guys can make a good game together, but it will be interesting.
47-minute video, then they run through a hallway for 18 minutes, and then an 80-minute video. Nothing happens.
They've been doing a radio play sequel to Snatcher called Pseudonatcher.
Pseudonatcher. Yes.
Look, ultimately these guys at Grasshopper, they are distinct guys. What they bring to the table is, I feel, very fresh in the video game industry, and that's why I really love their games.
Yes, I'm always respectful of that. It doesn't necessarily mean I want to play the game, but I'm always happy that people are doing things that no one else is doing.
Right. I know we're towards the end of a console cycle, which is when it gets worse. But the sameness of sequels, where it's just, all right, do the same thing, but make it even flashier. Mm-hmm. Can we make 16 things blow up during this sequence of scripted events versus 12 versus 10? It's if you watch an E3 press conference now, there's going to be a 10-minute trailer of the latest Medal of Honor game. I mean, not Medal of Honor.
Modern Warfare
game.
Same thing.
And yeah, they are. They're basically the same thing. You're going to watch this trailer and be like, how is this different from last year's game? And I appreciate that they're doing batshit crazy whatever the hell they're doing.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up this retroactive. So thanks to everybody who did play along. Thanks to everybody who posted in the forum thread. I didn't get to read all the ones I had picked out, but there are some more very good posts in there. Again, there's the crazy encyclopedic analysis from Lithium that you can go check out if you're a super fan. And the thread, as always, will remain open. And if you are a little bit behind and you're just now getting into the game, or if you have played some of it and you want to keep playing more of it, or if this discussion has inspired you to give it a shot, then the forum thread is a very good place to post in there and get the attention of other people who are also interested in the game. And maybe we'll be posting in there as well if we keep playing it. I would like to, so we'll see if I have time. And, of course, Carl, thank you very much for bringing your expertise to the subject.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys. Now I never have to talk about this game again.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up the episode. As always, you can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and I believe we will probably have emails next week. What we won't have is me next week. I'm going to take a week off because I've got somebody coming into town, a friend, and we're going to be going to some concerts, and it's not going to work out for me to be on the show next week, so I leave it in the capable hands of these men, and they
John.
Do a great show for you.
Thank you.
And before you go, if you're looking for other things to listen to, we got you covered, because every week there's the newscast. We've got a new episode coming up very shortly, I think, of Radio Trivia with Zach Miller. There's the Famicast, just came out, episode 4, so that's on our feed, so you probably already have it. Make sure you listen to it. And Carl has a number of things if you cannot get enough of Carl Castaneda,
you can go check him
out on Box Office Poison, for instance, which we're recording in a couple days, and we're going to talk about Return to Oz. And that was my pick for the movie of the month. I'm very, very thrilled. A lot of people don't even know that there is a movie sequel to The Wizard of Oz, and that it's, in my opinion, really awesome. Very interesting. So I think we'll have a lot to talk about with that movie.
If you only have to listen to one Crosstalk podcast, though, I recommend that you listen to their latest episode of Rough Draft, because it will offer stunning revelations of its own.
Yes, indeed. Well, if you've ever thought, I really like Carl, but I wish he was more drunk, then Rough Draft is the show for you.
Yes.
Yes, it is a really funny, entertaining show. And Carl and I also actually just did a couple episodes of my other show, Discover Music Project. We talked about Neil Young, and then Carl picked out a band called The Raining Sound, which is pretty obscure. I'd never even heard of it before, so I learned a lot more about that band. Mm. And so if you like a little bit more of the punk thing, you might appreciate that. There's a lot of stuff over there. Carl does a really good job of curating all these very diverse shows over at Crosstalk. So I always recommend that as well. So we got you on video games. We got you on non-video games. We got the whole website you can go check out with all the stuff we talked about now playing. Go forth, my friends, and enjoy the internet. Welcome back to Radio Free Nintendo. You know, every month we have a podcast.
What?
He's preempting. He's preempting. I get that. But I don't know how many.
Good. It's a box office poison.
That's
joke.
A box office poison reference.
I knew Carl
reference.
Would appreciate it.
Yeah, that's nice. That's a good piece of business. So we're going to start in the review section with Neil's review of Cartoon Network Fist Time Explosion.
Punch Time.
Oh shit, that was Punch Time.
Fist Time. Where did that come
from?
Freudian slip there.
Congratulations, you are the new John Lindemann.
Cartoon Network, BDSM, Water Sports, Fist Time Explosion.